Hello and welcome to the first ever special episode of the Crate and Crowbar. Amazingly, it's been 3.5 years of sort of talking a bit about maybe doing stuff like this. We're actually finally doing it. My name is Chris Thurston and I'm joined by Tom Francis.
Hello.
Just the two of us because we're the only two that have finished Dishonored 2 and therefore are capable of spoiling it relentlessly. Which is the plan. So if it goes, should go without saying, if you've downloaded this or clicked on the YouTube link or something, that this episode is going to treat nothing as off limits when it comes to spoilers for Dishonored 2. So if you don't want that, then go away. But also, you know, it's a game that's well worth playing without having had it spoiled for you.
Yeah.
So it has, you know, I think, I mean, we've talked about a little bit on the podcast, the regular podcast, but certainly has our endorsement, which is why we're doing this. So yeah, go away and play it and come listen to this when you are done. So, we thought the best way of structuring this would be to actually just sort of talk through the game as we experienced it. We've each got points we want to hit about particular missions and powers and stuff like that, but it probably makes sense to start at the top, I guess.
Hmm.
So we both played Emily for our first runs through the game, didn't we? Have you subsequently played Corvo much?
I have played two runs as Emily and just started Corvo.
Okay. I've done a full Emily and half a Corvo.
It's like currency.
Indeed. That was a low chaos Emily and then a high chaos Corvo.
Right. So I did low chaos Emily, then I did high chaos Emily, and now I'm doing what I thought was going to be very low chaos Corvo. My idea for it was like, cause I've been through it twice and I've been through it very thoroughly. This time I want to just skip stuff and I want to see like how, if you're just going for your objective, how well can you do that? And also I want to be never detected. And, this is like for all my playthroughs, I think about not so much like who am I and what am I doing, but how does this look to my enemies? And so for my core run, the thing I want to achieve is, I vanish, obviously, like they think they have me imprisoned or whatever, and I vanish from that. And then everyone important to their plan just disappears. There's no body ever found. No one ever sees me. No one else is killed. No one else is even knocked unconscious. Just all of the key players just vanish from the earth. And Delilah never knows what happens. That's my goal.
That's not unlike the no trace playthrough in episode one. Although that was deliberately making each kill explainable, but not by Corvo.
Yeah, for me, it's going to be incredibly suspicious, but the only rule is the bodies can never be found. So for the first guy, I just, I actually did kill him, but I also locked him in the safe room so that no one would ever find his body. And then for everyone else, I want to actually disintegrate them. Shadow kill or throw them into a ball of light or.
I mean, like briefly on the characters, like it's interesting because I'm planning on doing sort of the same thing. I'm doing my next run. Well, no, my run after that will be extremely low chaos Corvo because Corvo's skill set is more tuned to pure stealth than Emily's is.
Yeah, I was thinking like possession to get through certain walls of light.
Stop time
like
is like a game, like, you know, I think Emily's almost defined by the fact that she doesn't have access to stop time. Like a lot of her abilities allow you to, like Domino, which I think will probably deserve half a podcast in that, right? Because it's so brilliant. But Domino sort of, only works for Emily because she doesn't also have access to stop time in that sense. It is your answer to room full of dudes. But all of her solutions tend to be like more broadly powerful, but not stealthy if you're using them in the broad way.
Yeah.
Or in that, especially if you're trying to do a sort of completely ghost sort of run.
So for your first run, were you Emily low chaos?
Emily, okay. So for
did you have like a strict rule?
My first run was to, my rule was to, try and respect the character's motivations. Cause I like, you know, I care about the story. And it's more that I want it to feel like a real adventure, like you're being told the story or, you know, you're experiencing it like a novel or something. So, I wanted to respect Emily's motivations. But that doesn't mean strictly non-lethal or lethal. It's more case by case. This is always like the first way I play a given Deus Ex game is to go like, what would the character do? And Dishonored, I think, supports that because often it actually respects the fact that some people are dicks and you might kill them and some people aren't. But also to try and do the most sort of expeditious, approach to a given solution. So like, it doesn't mean not being experimental, but it means like, the crazy experimenting, the stuff that you do and you're really comfortable with the systems and you want to see how creatively you can kill somebody. Mm-hmm. I sort of leave that out because like it's, you know, again, it's supposed to be a real crisis that's happening to somebody. And so like, you know, the, it's hard to take a character on a sensible journey from, you know, exiled empress fighting to reclaim her throne and save her father's life to, I wanted to kill this person by flinging a barrel of whale oil at them just because I wanted to see if I could.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the example of this I can give you is, so the first mission, Dumble Tower, my approach was, I choked out the guards, because, you know, partly my take on Emily was that unlike Corvo, she's not a killer when the game begins. Like, the opening sequence when you're at, when you're Emily before you've picked a character, establishes Corvo as lethal straight away.
Yeah.
And that it's not, you know, the game has its own sense of who Corvo was. And it seems, I actually wrote something about this, but now having played Dishonored 2, it seems like the canon Corvo, I guess, that whoever he was in the first game is what is the hidden medium chaos. Cause the first game has a hidden medium chaos setting.
Wait, what does that mean?
So you have chaos and low chaos.
Mm.
The first game has certain parameters of the ending that trigger under basically like a hidden medium chaos thing, which is where you get the, I think it's where you get the bad version of the final mission of Dishonored 1, where it's all lightning and thunder rather than a clear day.
Yep. I never saw the clear day
one. Okay. It's not the clear day one, but it's not the ending where Samuel sets the alarm off as he goes. Because on the highest chaos of Dishonored 1, Samuel's like, you're a fucking asshole. Yeah. I don't even know why I'm driving you here. Like, honk. Like, it's the one where Samuel still respects you, but it's closer to high chaos than low chaos, I think is the canon outcome of Dishonored 1. And that's kind of backed up by that opening sequence of Dishonored 2, where the moment Corvo's sees that you're in danger, he stops time, which is such a cool thing to see from the outside.
Yeah. And now that I started playing as Corvo, I can't remember when it exactly happens, but one of those kind of like, voiceover bits where there's some sort of artwork. I think he's talking about his time in Karnaca, and you just see him kill a bunch of people, like in that kind of flashback thing.
Mm.
And so, yeah, they seem to be setting him out as lethal.
Yeah, he's always been like, so my take on Emily though is that like, I'm not sure exactly like whether or not she kills somebody in the books, but even though she's been out on the rooftops, you know, having adventures and stuff, it sort of makes sense to me that she's not like instantly going to use lethal power necessarily, like if you can't avoid it. And also I quite liked straight away this idea of the character is like clever, like maybe less of, even though both of them can solve problems in clever ways, like Emily's sort of characterization, the way she sort of approaches situations and the way she speaks, particularly low chaos Emily, strikes me as like more of a sort of like trickster problem solver than a hardcore assassin.
It's interesting, I'm gonna end up doing basically almost the opposite, in that my Corvo run is going to be like as avoidant as possible, killing nobody, only killing the targets. And my first Emily run, I did want to do low chaos, but I also, had a similar thing where I kind of wanted to play as how I thought this character would play. But my version of that character was, she's been in power her whole life, and the intro, I don't love the main plot, but it's very simple, and I kind of like the theme of it. And for me, my interpretation of it was like, I'm someone who's been in power my whole life. I've never known anything other than being in power except that brief period of my childhood where I was kind of kidnapped for a while. And here is someone like, even from a very well-balanced person's point of view, it would be jarring and horrific to have power taken away from you to the extent that Delilah does in the intro. Like, everything is stripped away and you're totally powerless, and so is Corvo. And it's this kind of shocking moment that jars you out of, everything. And I thought my character is like quite entitled and quite used to getting her way. She's not like a jerk, but this is totally outside of her, ability to cope. And so her immediate reaction is just like fury. And so I killed everyone in Dunwall Tower. And then as soon as I got out into the streets, that's when I started going non-lethal. It was kind of like the people who literally betrayed me in this room, like that, the captain of your guard and all these people, they know what they're doing. They know they're betraying you. Mm. And so they all had to die. And then once I got out into the street, I was like, are these just the city guard? Do they even understand what's just happened? And so for those people, I had mercy and I would choke them out. And then anytime I encountered Delilah's witches, I would kill them because I decided that they were in. So I did it very much like case by case, but like I decided certain people who really knew what they were doing, they had to die. anyone else was like, well, maybe they're just someone doing their job, so I'll be nice.
So I, like, interestingly, that's sort of where I've gone with Corvo, because, like, you know, my Corvo approach is like, this has happened again. And, like, when you kill that first target, the conspirator, Captain of the Guard guy, in the tower, when you kill him, Corvo says, like, that's for my daughter, you asshole.
Mm.
And, like, there's a sort of, this was the first for me, whereas Emily, like, I like her line when you choke the guy out and stash him in the safe room. And she says,
I haven't done that to Emily.
She says something like, you know, have fun drinking tap water and eating the rations.
Yeah, so Corvo says that as well.
They do share some lines, don't they?
So I've done, with Corvo, I choked him out. I avoided every other guard, didn't touch them at all, and just followed him into the safe room. And then once he was in the safe room, I was like, okay, I'm going to take this guy out, but I haven't decided how yet. And I didn't want to just choke him out. It was kind of too gentle, and I hadn't decided yet whether I was going to kill him. All I knew was that no one should ever find him. And so the first thing I tried to do was grab him from behind and then throw him down the stairs. And unfortunately, that counts as being spotted, even if you immediately, like, duck around the corner. Like, once he comes out of ragdoll, he just counts as spotting you. Mm. You see, like, the red markers. And so I couldn't do that quite. So I reloaded and I let him walk down the stairs. Then I jumped on his head and did, like, the non-lethal drop takedown, where you smash his head into the floor, which is very satisfying. And then I locked the door leading into this, at which point he says, I can't remember what it is, but yeah, the line about,
tap water and rations.
Yeah, enjoy, like, it was, enjoy those things whilst sleeping next to a fortune.
Because yeah.
There's always gold there as well. So it's kind of like he's saying, you know, you have all these riches, but you can't spend them in this kind of like, slightly, sort of like a fable sort of punishment. Like, you know, sounds like something that'll come up in a sort of moralistic lesson. But then I decided I want to kill him. And so I could just stab him while he's lying there, but I decided I'd take him up back up the stairs and throw him off the stairs. And then when he dies, then Corvo says, and that's for my daughter.
I've been sleeping in here.
I'm conflicted about this.
To death.
Yeah, exactly.
I locked him in that room and choked out the other guards and left the guards in the throne room. Actually, no, I went into the throne room to check on Corvo's statue. And she says, like, I'll find a way of wrecking. I wanted to see there wasn't some more interaction there. And then out in the streets, I dropped down from the roof and ended up hiding in one of those like metal guard huts.
Mm.
And there's some guards like talking outside and they're saying, you know, it's the conversation where it expresses whether or not they've found the body of that first target. Yeah. And then one of those guards, I was trying to not quick save too much and trying to respect that. So one of those guards, spotted me like a bit, but not a lot. People were investigating and I ended up hiding underneath the desk in that like shadowy guard hut with, like there's corpses on the floor in there. And it does establish that like the guards that are still around in the streets are the ones that have just enacted the coup and killed a lot of their own.
Yeah. I probably could have killed them.
Yeah. and then a guy came into that room and I was like, I'm still, you know, thinking, what would I actually do? Not trying to perfect it or anything. So I rushed that guy and lethally took him down before he could react. I like the way that there's a window for it'll accept a lethal takedown even from the front.
Yeah.
Like if you're fast enough, which makes sense, right? You sort of grab him and then slit his throat and he's down. And I sort of in my head canon version of it, that's like the first time Emily's killed somebody and it's over super quickly, but it was quite horrific because I was like hiding in a corpse pile as well. Killed him.
So you didn't kill the, captain?
No, I choked him out. Cause that again felt like I'm smarter than you. Like I got the drop on him, like dropped off the balcony and you know, kneed him in the face. And again, it felt more appropriate that she's subtle, right? So she's clever and, you know, she sort of outthought these people. And then I snuck past the armory, which is at the sort of far end of the street from where you're ultimately going. And this was, I guess, maybe a little bit of trying to think how, using my knowledge of how the first game does things to try and figure this out. But basically then I managed to climb on top of one of the little guard boxes, jump onto some sort of like industrial power unit box. And from there get onto a pipe, that slightly overhangs a piece of wood that is lying across the tracks for the train car thing that comes through occasionally. You could jump onto the wood to avoid getting electrocuted, then jump across onto another set of pipes, which climbs up to an area above the train tracks. Mm-hmm. And then as the train came through, I jumped on top of that,
right,
rode it. And then there's like a bit where it goes through like a little low bridge thing. So you've got to like, and it felt really cool. I was riding this thing and then you can stop there and it'll like autosave for you, I think. But if you jump and then you can do like a jump and then a butt slide across like the roof of the bridge and then like slide off onto the train as it comes through the other side, which felt nice. Like such a sort of, you know, action movie kind of parkour moment, and ride that all the way to the far end of the level where I jump off again and then got onto a long pipe, which jutted out into the sea, jumped off into the sea and stayed under the water until I got to the dreadful whale.
Yeah. So I remember you saying that you'd found a good route to skip most of that opening section, and I had really struggled with that opening section. I actually had a really bad experience as Emily. You have no powers at this point. You don't even have the crossbow. You only have the gun and the knife, basically. I was also playing on hard mode, which I think at the time I didn't know that affected people's detections.
I was playing on hard as well.
And I was just trying to slip by those first few guards, and I was having a really tough time doing it. I reloaded like 27 times in that first section. I just couldn't get past that first group. And to this day, I think it's the hardest part of the game. I don't think any other part's given me as much trouble. And I wasn't enjoying it because I didn't have a lot of options. But next time I played it, I got through it eventually and just trial and error and just found a way to do it perfectly. And then I remembered you saying that there was like you saw another route through this place. I didn't know about the train at that time. And so my second run, I found a route across the rooftops, like right at the start. You start on a rooftop and then you go down into the street. And instead of going down into the street, I found a way to jump onto another rooftop and then you can kind of like go around the side. And so I thought that was the route you're talking about, and I got past most of it. I think I then went back and killed everybody because this is my high chaos playthrough. I literally just murdered everybody.
Actually, I forgot something. Fuck all of you.
But from that side, it's way easier. You get to jump on everyone. And that's really like satisfying. And then on my third time, which I just started as Corvo, I did the same higher up route, and there's this bit where if you take the route that I took the second time through, you get really, really high up and you cross, to another rooftop across these like, steel beams, way above the train tracks. And then once you get to the other side, there isn't really anywhere to go from there. And the first time through, I thought, okay, you just got to drop down from here and then take the streets the rest of the way. And then as it happened, the timing worked out that as I crossed this time, a train went beneath me. And just the thought occurred to me, like, could you jump on that? And I, like, the height looked like it would kill you. And so I thought, you probably can't, but I'm going to save it. I'm going to try it. Like, I actually loaded my old save game because the train had gone past at that point. I didn't know if they're on a regular schedule. And so I loaded my old save game and just thought, I'm just going to try this. And not only do you not die, but you don't even take damage dropping onto it. And then I had the same thing where, like, I didn't manage to do a butt slide, but I had that great moment where you're on the train, you're coming towards it, and you realize this bridge is going to hit me. So jump onto the bridge, ran across the top of it, and jump back onto the train. And then, yeah, it takes you all the way to the pipe, which is awesome.
Yeah. So, like, I've now been back through that area as Lethal Corvo and seen a bunch of the stuff that you miss, like the Crown Killer murder scene.
Yeah.
And the pub and the office of the Dunwall Courier, you know, the newspaper where you can like save the newspaper editor.
Yeah, you can save him twice and you can rob one of the houses there twice. And there's an achievement for both. Like, I haven't done the robbing one, which is actually, that's where the 0451 code is used.
Yeah.
Which I didn't find that. I've still never been there. But it did on my first playthrough. I was thinking, I wonder where that code is. Cause the first code I did get wasn't that. And I thought, I bet there is an 0451 code in this game.
Which is, if you don't know, it's the Deus Ex code. Yeah. It's the first gate code in.
I think even before Deus Ex, I think maybe System Shock 1 had it.
Oh, really?
It's a reference to Fahrenheit 451.
So that was like, I was very conscious when I was doing it that like, I've just skipped a lot, but it felt right.
Yeah.
Like it felt more like, also because it didn't confront me with the need to kill any more people. Like I killed a few people, but then my escape was sort of like, again, like clever rather than ninja-like or stealthy. It was just like, saw a train, thought that's my way out. I'm going to try and figure out how I can get to that. Cause I assume from my knowledge of like the first game that like those details are often not there for no reason. Like there's always like a kind of.
I hadn't gotten to that mode at that point. That's why I didn't see this route in the first place is I sort of saw this as a tutorial section and that like getting past these guards is part of how they're teaching you about stealth. And so I didn't question that I had to get past them in that way. And now I think it was, the reason I noticed on my second playthrough and an even better way on the third playthrough was just that I was much more in the mindset of like, this is a game where there is always a high road. There's always a way to jump up and get across somewhere from above.
So that brings us to, I guess, like Megan, the Dreadful Whale, Outsider, powers and Konaka, which like is quite a lot.
I am no more fond of the Outsider than I was in Dishonored 1.
I don't hate it as much as other people do. I think it's sort of one of those things, like, I don't know how they, I think it's still, I still like that the Outsider isn't that important to the plot. Like, even though the Outsider plays like a bit more of a direct role in this one, at least at one crucial moment, than he does in the first game. Mm. And you get a little bit more of a sense of who he is or who he might be or what's going on. I still sort of, I like that they haven't felt the need to like expand on his mythology more. He's still sort of just like this, an unexplained, you know? Like,
I think a lot of my problems would be fixed if he was just very voluntary. Like, getting the powers and stuff would be on the critical path, but all the sort of the stuff he does talking to you was something that he does if you ask him. Like, if you go to the Outsider and say, hey, what's going on? Or what are you, like,
I suppose it's kind of by going to the shrines, right?
Yeah, but the problem is the runes are on the shrines. Yeah. By taking the runes, you trigger the cutscene. And if I could take the runes without triggering the cutscene, I would totally do that.
Mm.
And it's not just that I want to avoid this content. It's that, the content itself is spoiled by the fact that I didn't ask for it, because it makes him seem like, awkward loner. Like, every time he's talking to me, I'm like, why are you saying that? I've never given you any indication that I give a shit what you think. And he's always like,
something.
Would you like to hear my life story?
I don't know how true this is, but in the start of the game, he does comment on your, particularly in the first time you meet him, he does comment on the way you've just played that mission. Like, his dialogue changes quite a lot from high chaos to low chaos. But elsewhere in the game, it felt to me like he says less stuff that's reactive than in the previous game, which I think I think the game does a fine job of reflecting your choices at other times, but I think that's one of the things that makes the Outsider feel a little bit less integral this time around. Like, in the first game, particularly in the DLC, particularly in the Dowd stuff, like, it's very clearly tailored to what you've just done, like whether you've shown mercy to a target or not. Whereas I found most of the time he was there to say sort of exposition stuff, which has always been like the weakest side of the Outsider character for me, has always been him saying like, this person's kind of evil, but aren't they just misunderstood? Who knows? Like, and then vanish. Whereas, you know, like when that was always coupled with, and it doesn't seem to matter to you because you've killed everybody, or I'm surprised you've done something more subtle than that or whatever. That I think made it feel like, it felt like it was your like way of checking in with the chaos system in a way. Particularly, because the first game, well, the Corvo side of the first game was a little bit more subtle with surrounding you by characters that reacted to that. Emily reacted to who you were becoming, but often her reactions were a bit quite subtle. Dowd, again, it was more obvious because Billy Lurk reacts in a pretty substantial way in her approval or disapproval of who you're becoming. And so, like, there was maybe a bit more of it, but I think without that kind of like tactile, the Outsider is somehow testing me or watching me, maybe he felt a little less important. I don't know. But the other thing I was going to say is that the heart, which I still think is a brilliant system, the heart seems to sort of do a lot of the sort of otherworldly metaphysical heavy lifting for the story anyway. Like, a lot of the kind of the most sort of interesting mythology stuff in the game comes from pointing the heart at people and squeezing it. And a lot of your sense of the kind of, you know, the otherworldly nature of your powers and the weirdness of the game comes more successfully from the heart with the voice of the Dead Empress than it does from the Outsider.
Is it always people that it responds to?
Places. If you are in a place and you squeeze it, it will respond to the place.
That was, so I didn't really use it on guards. I knew that you get a whole bunch of different lines and stuff. I like that that's there, but I didn't especially want to engage with it because something in the back of my head is always saying, this is just like a random flag, or like, it's not really about this guard. I don't mind that's the case, but it means I'm not going to actively kind of seek that out, or I'm not going to get super invested in it because I kind of, I still see it as a game system. And so when I did use the heart, I mean, 90% of the time I was using it to see where the nearest rune or bone charm is, but then I would squeeze it sometimes accidentally. And I guess because I wasn't intentionally using it, I would just end up getting the same line a lot of times. It would just always be like, oh, there is darkness in the place, but yes, there is goodness too. But all right, whatever.
It's a bit better at telling you when it's run out of things to tell you about a person now, which is good.
Yeah.
It sounds like, why the hell? Oh, God.
I told you everything I know about this guy.
And I mean, maybe to skip ahead of the heart a bit, there's, I think, like, when you're pointing it at, you know, more substantial characters, there's so much good stuff hidden away through that system.
Right. Actually, I just read on Twitter shortly before this podcast that if you pointed at Mindy...
Isn't this the mission we're talking about, really? Which is the Streets of Karnaca.
Apparently, it says something along the lines of she was born into a life she didn't want, but she did something about it. I can't remember how it phrases it, but something like that. And someone was asking Harvey Smith on Twitter, like, I read this as she is trans. Is that true? And he says, in my version, yes. So he doesn't quite, like, 100% say, but basically says, yeah, in his head, she is.
So one thing, like, there's a lot of good stuff if you use it on most of the sort of named, the major characters. But, so I'll put it this way, because you played Knife of Dunwall, right?
Yes.
Because obviously
it turns out I didn't remember it as well. The Billy Lurk thing.
That's what I was going to say.
When it happened, I was like, who's that? And then like 5 minutes later, I'm like, oh yeah, I think I do remember that character. And I also played the witches thing, but I think I only played like half of the witches of Brimhall.
Oh, so the
and
end.
So there's a lot of stuff that I didn't.
Surprisingly essential DLC.
Yeah, it almost felt like Dishonored 2 relates more to the DLC of Dishonored 1 than it does to the plot.
It's got that in common with Dragon Age Inquisition, weirdly, which is a game that follows off from a piece of DLC for Dragon Age 2 more than Dragon Age. That comparison occurred to both me and Phil Savage, who reviewed it for us. So the Billy Lurk thing, I'd figured it out about halfway through the game.
Oh, really?
Awesome. Yeah, because of there are a lot of clues. And I had replayed all of Dishonored and its DLC recently because I was sort of interested.
Yeah, I wish I'd done that now.
So the first thing was like, there are just references, things Megan says that are like slightly... It suggests that she's had a bit more of a history with, you know, magic and assassins more than just being a boat captain who's seen some shit. And also the fact that she's had this past. And so this is skipping to a revelation from right at the end of the game, but, if you point the heart at her earlier, there's not clues, but if you're already thinking it, there's a lot that will tip you over into,
right.
Oh shit. Like she feels bad about the fact that she helped kill my mum. Like,
did you, hear the thing about the name, the Dreadful Whale? So this is the thing. Harvey Smith was a sort of like competition on Twitter where he says there's a secret in Dishonored or an Easter egg that I haven't heard anyone mention yet that you can get just from the marketing materials. You don't need to have played the game. And if the first person to get it, I'll give them a Dishonored Collector's Edition. And I was never going to get it, so I didn't try, but I followed along the conversation and read a bunch of suggestions, quickly realizing, oh shit, these are full of spoilers. and then the answer was that the Dreadful Whale is an anagram of Farewell Dowd.
Oh, wow.
And that's why it's spelt W-A-L-E. There's no H in it.
Well, it's a gun whale on a boat, right?
Oh, right.
Like, that's what, like, it's like the metal sidings on a ship.
Ah, okay.
It's a whale, I think. I think that's right.
He gave a bunch of clues for it, and one of them was like, it's something to do with spelling. And I had noticed that is not the way you spell whale is in the thing. Mm. It's sort of there's something about it sounds wrong.
Huh. Cause when I went to Arcane to see the game, in April, they actually mentioned, like, they were very clean to point out, it's spelled like this, not like this. I mean, there might be room for our benefit as journalists that we have to write about this, but that's awesome. Cause so I started to see that comparison and the fact that she has a locked door in her cabin. And it felt like something that she would be keeping from me because it's a good, you know, it makes sense.
She's got a good reason to keep that from
me. But also, like, the fact that, like, I think in an interview or something, Harvey Smith had established that, like, the ending of the Knife of the Brigmore Witches where Dowd is spared by Corvo, that's the end of the Brigmore Witches.
Okay.
Is their encounter, but from Dowd's point of view. And Corvo kills him if you're on High Chaos and doesn't kill him if you're not. Which sort of links their two fates. It means that Merciful Corvo is linked to Merciful Dowd, and that's the canon one, so it kind of informs you about the two different characters at once. You know, that implied to me that the version of events where Dowd doesn't kill Billy Lurk, but lets her go, and the last thing you get from her is a letter saying, like, I'm on a boat and I'm leaving. Right. Like, it all sort of linked together, and I started to see it, and I was like, oh, shit, this is... So, yeah.
I should replay them A, because of this, and B, because of the question we got on the main podcast about finding runes by solving all these treasure hunts. Yeah. I never did that.
Yeah.
That was totally news to me. Also, I don't know what changed exactly, but in Dishonored 1, I don't remember, like, really rigorously hunting down all the runes and bone charms. And in Dishonored 2, I did. I didn't in Karnaca, so, like, I guess where we are in discussing this now is, like, when you arrive in Karnaca, you're at this dock, and I just, for some reason, I got it in my head, this was a hub that I was going to come back to a whole bunch of times, and so I didn't bother to find all the bone charms and runes. I just moved on to my mission, thinking I'm going to come back for those later, and I didn't get the chance to come back for them later, and so I just missed out on a whole bunch of them. And then from that moment on, I didn't actually find them all. On my second playthrough, I have pretty much found every single one in all the game. But for me, that, like, this time through, that became, like, almost 50% of the game was just find all the runes and all the bone charms, not because you need the bone charms, but because this is how you make sure you've seen all the level. Sort of saw it as like the level designer talking to me and saying, this is a place worth going to. Like, the bone charm you find here will be one extra bullet in an ammo pack every now and then, which you don't give a fuck about. But it's in this apartment that if you look around it has something interesting about it, or they'll, it's just kind of a place worth seeing that's different to everywhere else.
Or in that level, it helps direct you towards like the safe challenge, like to try and crack open to that safe in the security lock shop, which is in the basement of the same building as Alexandria Hypatia's apartment. And getting into that gives you some clues of what's going on in the asylum.
Hypatia's apartment, knowingly at least. So there are a whole bunch of safe shops in the game.
Yeah. There's an achievement for robbing all of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So which is the one in Karnaca Docks?
So Karnaca Docks, it's opposite the station building that you need to get to, the kind of main station building.
Right.
But it's like, it's probably like the furthest point from where you start. Like, it's quite far.
And does it have like a rune or a bone charm in it?
So there's a bone charm. There's a rune in the safe.
Okay.
And there's it's like a competition to like who can crack this safe.
Yeah. And it's like the sort of a marketing thing. Like, come and try your luck. And
yeah.
You can only have 30 minutes. I can't remember how I cracked that one, because I was talking to Alex about this, and he didn't find the combination for it, and I did, and I can't remember how I did.
I'd been chased in there by guards and hid under a table until the guards went away, and then choked out the shopkeeper because I wasn't sure if he would like tell on me, basically. Yep. So I snuck him, and then I just hid him in the back room, and then robbed the till, and the combination is in the till.
Right, okay, yeah. I remember that being the solution to one of them. I couldn't remember if that
was
the
same
one.
And then in the back room, there's like a letter saying, can you water my plant, Hypatia, with a key to her apartment, which is upstairs. There's a lot of other ways into
that
her apartment.
That part I missed.
But yeah, like, that was my way into her apartment. And you hear like some, you know, there's like a voice recording by her talking about her work, and it kind of establishes her as like a fundamentally good person
right. Quite
early. So like, even on High Chaos as Corvo, he says like, I'm going to have to get what I need to know from her. But she sounds nice. But yeah, that first level, I don't think anything sort of enormously stood out to me in terms of like the decisions I was making, but very quickly kind of, I love that environment. Like, I think it's one of the best sort of like introductions to us.
Yeah, that was when the game started to click for me. Like, I struggled with the opening section, and then by that time I just had Far Reach and that was it. But that was enough that I'm like, oh yeah, I remember why I liked Dishonored.
Playing it through recently as Corvo on my kind of like pretty ghost playthrough, I did do a stealth solution to something that I'm really pleased with and is very Dishonored, which is, and again, involving trains, which apparently my thing. So after I got the body for, what's her name again?
Mindy.
I was sort of on the lampposts outside, like going the high route down towards the dentist where she's waiting. But the problem I had is there's like two tiers at that point. There's a market on the ground floor below you. But then ahead of you, there's the train station, which is elevated like an overhead train station. And there's just a bunch of people hanging around. And if I drop...
It's like the carriage station.
Yeah, so the carriage. Sort of the
weird car thing.
Weird car carriage station thing. And I felt like, I found that if I, and I needed to go like down and around a corner to get to the dentist's basement, which is where I'm meeting Mindy. And I can't do that blink without the cooldown on blink getting me spotted, because I'm holding a body, which means that they almost immediately see you. There's no like recognition. It's like bing immediately. So the way I ended up doing it was waiting till I could hear the kind of like of an approaching train car, slowing time because I don't have full stop time, And then as the train car moves past to occlude the vision of the man that can see me, jumping onto a, jumping forwards onto a lamppost that's like between us, where he'd normally be able to see me, turning and immediately blinking down into the stairwell leading down to the dentist's basement. But in the split second it takes for the time slowed train car to pass in front of this guy's face, which made me think of the, you know, that like spy movie cliche of like the person standing on the opposite side of the road and the bus goes past and they're gone. You never know how that works. Cause that's like, someone should make the spy movie where like the bus goes past and you just see the person running away. Yeah,
exactly. It's not going to be cool. Is it?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas that was actually exactly that. And yeah, it's like, felt really cool.
Chris Livingston's Concerned comic about Half-Life 2, like, shows all the ways the G-Man get, like, disappears the way he does, and it's just, like, hiding behind a crate.
But that was actually that, which... Was...
Did you... So I don't remember when this happened, but at some point I was in a dentist's office on my High Chaos Emily playthrough, and there was a bunch of, like, sort of model heads with teeth that were obviously, like, dentist's sort of practice things, and I got the opportunity to use them, so I did. And High Chaos Emily said something that is very High Chaos Emily. Maybe when I find Delilah, I'll have a dentist rip out all her teeth.
Oh, wow.
And she's just like, very early on, it takes a while, like, it takes a mission or two before you're sort of established as High Chaos. And I was really High Chaos. I killed 43 people on the first level of the game. At some point on mission, on the Karnaka docks, I think I walked past a wall of light and she said, I can think of some people I'd like to shove into this. And that was my first clue of like, this is a different person than the one I played last time. And so that was actually really, I didn't know there would be any, I was playing Emily again just because I wanted to use Domino in a lethal way and I hadn't done that. So, I wasn't expecting there to be any narrative payoff to playing the same character twice in two different ways, but there totally is. And, the first time though, I didn't really notice her commenting on things that much. So she obviously is a character and she says some stuff, but I feel like with High Chaos, she sort of takes every opportunity to say something and it just gets darker and darker. Like she starts out pretty strong with like, you know, I would kill some people if I could with this wall. And then, just various times she'll just say increasingly dark things. And like, I looked at a statue of, like an octopus in, I think, Jindosh's place. And it's just a giant, like, squid type thing, a sort of mythical, monster. And she says, with eight arms, I could choke eight men. Wow. Okay.
Jesus Christ, Emily.
And then, then she said the dentist thing about smashing in Delilah's teeth. And then, there's sort of tipping point where I realized, oh, I've just created a monster. Whereas when I, like, looked at a metronome and she said, something like a heartbeat stops with every tick, let it run forever. Like, okay, you've crossed the line into you just want everyone in the world to die.
yeah it's not gel with the sort of like clever problem solver Emily that I was playing through this.
And also when I was in a safe shop and I think it was quite late on and I was looking for the combination, I think I found it in the till, but while I was robbing the till I stole some coins, and as I stole some coins she said everyone will pay me what they owe me.
I think Corvo says something like, I deserve this after what I've been through when you steal money from a till. That's good. So that, I guess that brings us to Adamai, because I remember having that when I'm really loving a game, I always have that thing of like, oh no, it's rushing past me. And I actually thought, I thought Adamai was going to be the second half of mission one, really. Like I thought the streets that Karnaka docks area wasn't a mission in and of itself. I assumed it was the first half of the Adamai mission. Actually, there are two missions because Adamai is a very different thing.
Does it give you like a stat screen at the end?
It does. You get a stat screen when you get on the little carriage and it's Adamai's mission three.
That differs. I remember because there was times when I remember actually getting really confused because I would find every bone charm and rune on a level and then it would say, oh, you found 3 of 7. I'm like, what? How did I miss 4 bone charms? Yeah. Like, there was nothing. And then I realized, oh, it was the streets beforehand. Mm.
Most of the other missions have a street section that is included, I guess. But Adamai and that initial section are separate. And I think, you know, Adamai is like, it's probably not my favorite environment in the game because it feels like a return almost to Dunwall because it's a dark, gloomy...
Yeah, sort of run down...
mental institution.
Yeah.
Feels very old school thief as well. And this was the first level for me that I ended up not like gaming necessarily, but I cleaned out that place because I figured there was like a lot of secrets to find and a lot of stuff to do. What was your solution to that? Or did you do the non-lethal thing?
Yeah, I did. I had the most bizarre experience with it because there is, so you meet Dr. Hypatia and I talk to her and that's sort of, I wasn't actually that clear on what I was doing on that level. The Crown Killer aspect had not really sunk in. I knew that I was curious about who the Crown Killer was, but I was really just sent to Adamire and in my head, my objective was just to meet Hypatia. I didn't know what I was supposed to do with her.
And met Sokolov. So.
And she was crazy. Oh yeah, because you don't know he's not there at that point. Yeah. And so the idea of like resolving the Crown Killer mystery, was not on my mind. And then what happened to me was I met her, I talked to her, and then I went into a back room and I guess I like used one of her audio diary type things and I just kind of like clicked on it and it was just playing in the background while I kind of looted the place and I maybe wasn't focusing on it. I was kind of listening and the recording I heard did not clue me into the fact that Hypatia was the Crown Killer. So that was not clear to me. But the game clearly thought that I had understood this. And so she like in the background turns into the Crown Killer at that point. And the problem with it was for me that, I didn't know that. And then when I looked around, she is just tagged with the words, the Crown Killer. Like it just says, this is the Crown Killer. I'm like, how do I know that? What the fuck? And I believed it. I'm like, okay, that is the Crown Killer, I guess, but I don't know how my character knows this. I don't know why I think she's the Crown Killer. And I guess that audio log was supposed to be so conclusive that I would just know that Hypatia was the Crown
Killer. Cause I had like done a lot of like, by the time I got to this point, like almost every other guard in the building was unconscious and I'd been everywhere. So I knew that she was the Crown Killer by the time I met her because. Well, I knew, like, because it's obvious from the letters and the diaries and the other logs. And it's, well, at that point, it's the Occam's razor thing. It's like, either there's another person who fits her exact profile, who's also been doing the same thing she has, who is independently the Crown Killer, or she's the Crown Killer. And so I went and talked to her, but like, was a bit kind of taken aback that, oh shit, I don't have the option to go, I know it's you. So then I had to like run and try and like find the guy, the other doctor who is in that room, who I knew would be in there. I'd be like, fuck, fuck, fuck. And which made the bit where she comes like crashing through the window make a little bit more sense.
My first playthrough, I didn't get that at all. Okay. She didn't crash through the window. I think I listened to the audio log and then I walked back out into the room that where she was. And that was when she was suddenly labeled as the Crown Killer. She sort of staggers out into the middle of the room. As soon as you know something, she staggers out into the middle of the room and starts her transformation. And it's only if you talk to her assistant that she does the crashing through the window thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't talk to the assistant. And so that was what threw me. I was like, oh, suddenly she's the Crown Killer. Did you ever try to like choke her before she's revealed?
No, I think I tried to shoot her with a trank dart and that didn't work.
Okay. If you choke her, she's like, there's a whole sort of special like reaction she has to it where she like turns into the Crown Killer and,
oh, wow.
And
cool.
Attacks you. It doesn't work at least.
If that felt really scrappy for me, because I wasn't reloading, but actually felt really cool because I didn't know how far she would chase me. So like she won't chase you much beyond the kind of blood fly infested area that precedes her lab.
Yeah, it was interesting. Like she did roam much further than I thought she was going to. I thought I'm used to AI kind of staying in their spot, and she chased me upstairs for some reason. But I was long gone by the time she got upstairs. But then I was still creeping around downstairs, and she roamed well into the blood fly area, and
Because I managed to like lose her through there and then go and do the various things to make the cure.
Mm.
And then sneaking back in to kind of inject her, like, that felt like a genuine stealth bit because she can smell you, I think. Like she has a much bigger detection radius than other guards. And I ended up having to like wait until she was upstairs and then going back downstairs, like waiting on a little perch and then drop down behind her and immediately nab her with the serum, which felt like a very, I don't know, again, like a good moment, like a sort of clever Emily solution.
I did like, I think of this as one of my less favorite missions, but I did like the outdoor bits. Like every time I got out from the Institute and out onto like a balcony or a ledge or a roof, I realized how much this really was a building. You can go over the roof of every area and you can come at it from any angle you like. And there's kind of, I don't know, for some reason, like the rundownness in the interior, that feels like a cliche. And on the exterior, it feels kind of, striking, like it actually sort of was interesting to me. This very like felt very British somehow.
It's like a shitty sort of old rundown pier kind of.
Yeah, thing. Crappy sun lounges. I grew up in a place called Bognor Regis, and you can imagine that this is not unlike Adamire. sort of like this place that's designed for people to enjoy the nature, but
with
nature
solarium,
itself,
right? Like it's for people
grim
to,
and yeah. bleak.
I suppose there's a poetry to the fact that it's a solarium in the rain.
Yeah. Yeah, that spoke to me as an Englishman.
It was the first time I think I started to really like experiment with the powers. Cause obviously you don't have too many by then.
Yeah,
by this point
sure.
I had Domino.
Yep.
And I remember there's a bit where there's like a dining area with like multiple guards. Some of them are eating, some are having dinner with each other. And there's a rune on a plaque in that room. And I had gotten in through the room above where there's like a balcony or like a hole in the center of the thing. So you can perch up there. And I could only domino two people, but I was one rune off being able to domino three. So my solution to that bit was to far reach, grab the rune off the wall,
as we had the
fling it into myself,
thing. Yeah,
and then immediately go into the journal, get triple domino, link the three of them, and then drop choke one of them. And that felt like, again, just, you know, things, many things that's great about that game.
I think I had the far reach item grab thing at that point as well, because I think that was a room I remember being like one of the few places that was just tough. I couldn't figure out a good way of doing it, and so I just stole the rune and left. I never actually took those people out. This is also my introduction to the how spirits work in this world. Like as in type spirits, because I dominoed two people on a staircase and tranked one of them, and then when I came round the stairs and to view their unconscious bodies, they were both on fire. And it was, I posted this on Twitter, and I was posting it as kind of a joke, but I also said, if anyone does know how this happened, I'd be intrigued to know. And Harvey Smith said, it's the whiskey. Like if they have, if any of them is carrying any whiskey, I think it's just a bottle nearby and they fell on it. And if whiskey is disturbed in any way, it's going to set fire.
Speaking of which, would you like some more whiskey?
Yes. We've gathered for whiskey and cigars, but without the cigars.
We're all out of cigars.
Duke Nukem Dishonored.
Yeah, God. I think I spoke about this on the last pod, but that was also the level where I had my first, like, domino is accidentally extremely lethal sometimes problem. which I did talk about in the last pod, but I can clarify where it was. Which is the two guards overlooking the watchtower that you've got to shut off in order to allow Megan to come get you. I had a problem whereby one of them sort of stood like on the cliff, like overlooking, well, on a high ledge, like overlooking the sea. And the other one is sat on a box facing the door you come in. And I won't dwell on the story too much because I did tell it in the last pod. But the problem was, my thought was, I'm going to, place a stun mine on the box, prang the wall with my sword to lure the guy on the, who is sitting facing the door over. I'll domino the two of them. He'll get stun mined. I'll knock them both out. Bob's your uncle, non-lethal playthrough intact. And I ended up, this is one bit I did end up quick loading and playing just because I wanted to play with the system. But the funniest thing was every time I would clang my sword on the box, it wasn't even the domino thing. The guy standing over the cliff would be so surprised, he would just immediately fall forward off the cliff. And then the other, because he was linked to the other guy, the other guard would be like, what? And then crack. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. It wasn't like, I was killing that guy just by surprising him.
That was, my experience with domino on this level, like I just got domino and it was obviously only two targets and I was trying to be non-lethal. And so the thing I really enjoyed doing it, but it wasn't totally, didn't really align with my playstyle goals. Was you link two people and you choke one of them. And it's very common to be in a situation where you can choke one of them, but the other one's going to see at some point. And it's just a question of when they see. Mm. And if they're both looking at each other, then it's not going to work. But most of the time you can get it in a situation where you choke one of them. The other one's going to notice at some point during a choke, but they're dominoed to them. And so they see you, they recognize you, they draw their sword, they run towards you. And just as they get to you, that guy loses consciousness. And so they lose consciousness too.
Yeah.
And that was just a really cool moment every time.
Mm. I like, I did make some use of the combat choke as well, because I ended up getting spotted a few times. And I really appreciate that addition to the game generally. Mm. Like domino combat choke is sort of kind of legit as well, because often like, but also sometimes you'll get into the situation where they'll shoot anyway, kill the guy that you're choking, and kill themselves, which is a problem. Did you find the secret basement?
Yes. I can't remember if I did on my first playthrough, but on subsequent playthroughs, because there's like a rune or a bone charm down there, right? And so it tells you it's there, and
some Dishonored 1 Easter eggs.
If I remember correctly, it's a case of breaking the elevator cable so it smashes through the wooden floor.
Yeah.
Is it possible to smash through the wooden floor in some other way?
Not as far as I could tell, because that was like the last thing I tried, because that was like, I'd already done most of the mission and I was exploring, and I ended up, there's a sleeping guard like a corridor away, and apparently that was the only guard I hadn't choked out because he was already asleep. And because I tried throwing a sticky grenade down there and it went off, right. And I heard this guy go, what the fuck was that? And then like come out, apparently not notice any of the other asylum full of unconscious people. I ended up having to like choke him out as well, add him, put him in the bin with the other men.
But it didn't break the planks.
It didn't. I think you have to do the lift.
So the reason I wonder is that I don't remember, because I remember discovering this elevator thing later on in the game that you can slash the cables and it will smash through it, like sometimes smash through the ground floor. Sometimes it doesn't, depending on what the ground floor is made of. And I remember discovering that later in the game. And so I think I didn't know that when I came to Ademeyer. And so when I, on a subsequent playthrough, did that, because I was getting every single rune and every single bone charm, and I remember figuring that out and that being a sort of revelation, I sort of deduced that I didn't know that rule on the first time through, so I think I didn't find that.
Weirdly, it teaches you in the tutorials, no one will remember. The last thing you shoot with the crossbow in the tutorial is one of those red, breakers.
And it's behind like a grate type thing, and it's kind of hard to see, and the time when I did that tutorial, I couldn't tell what it was asking me to shoot, and I shot at where I thought it was trying to shoot like 10 times, and nothing happened. And then on the 11th time, it did break the thing, and it completed it. And so at the end of it, I was still totally unclear as to what it is I should shoot.
I figured that out after the fact as well. Like, it was after doing the elevator thing. I was like, oh, this is what it was trying to teach me.
I think that if they wanted to tutorialize that better, it should have been just like a bunch of like cables, and one of them has that big glowing orange weak spot thing, and it's like, hit that one.
So in the basement, you find the effects and a portrait of a former inmate of the solarium.
Yeah.
Did you recognize who that was? It's Granny Rags. Vera More is Granny Rags' real name. So yeah, you find a portrait of her when she was young and some effects and stuff. That's why the runes, because
I sure found her hand.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's a cool thing. But yeah, so.
So I don't know. I've only played that part as Emily. But when you take out Paolo, I really like Paolo. Like, the whole thing about him is great. Leader of the Howlers. Anytime he is killed, he turns into a swarm of rats and then resurrects somewhere else.
As Granny Rags does in Dishonored 1.
Yes. Yeah. But only once per day. And the thing I like about it is that you encounter him way before you can actually kill him. And he's visiting a black market, and you talk to the black market person, and she's like, you can't talk to me right now, but like, Paolo's going to be coming. And so I hid, and I don't know who the fuck that guy is. And I saw them come in, and I'm like, I don't know, the character I'm playing as, non-lethal as I am, I'm still going to, if a bunch of gangsters wander into a room that I'm in, I'm still going to take them all out. Mm. And so I domino linked them all, and I choked one out, and they all fell unconscious, and one of them turned into a bunch of rats. I was like, okay, that's new. And it's just like, at that point, I think I'd forgotten the Granny Rags thing. I remember the Granny Rags existed, but I didn't remember exactly how her thing worked. And to me, that was just totally mysterious, and it was just kind of a great moment of like, I felt like the game was telling me not to mess with this guy, and I did mess with this guy, and something weird happened, and I didn't get to sort of have any resolution on it until way later.
That is the next mission, though, isn't it? That section, because that is in the streets prior to the Clockwork Mansion, I believe.
Yeah.
Is that is the next section of the...
Yeah, I think so.
So there's Ademeyer, and then you go to Kirin Jindosh's house to get Sokolov.
Yeah.
Right.
And so then the thing where you actually can take out Paolo is before a crack in the slab mission, which is
next.
The next one. Yeah.
Yeah. So hang on. So we're on to 4, right? Which is the Clockwork Mansion.
Yes. So it felt to me like a long gap between the two times that I encountered Paolo. And that's because I was literally spending half a day on every mission. Like, that's the one of the things I loved about playing this was just, I really took my time with that. I think twice I took 2 days off to play this game just solidly for 2 days. And I loved actually taking my time with it and being thorough. And I did miss a whole load of runes and bone charms on the Karnaca docks. But after that, I was like, okay, so each mission is just something I'm going to explore thoroughly and just, take as long as I like. And particularly in a stealth game, that can be very time consuming, but just also like, it never feels boring. There's a new question actually on the Eurogamer podcast recently about someone writing in to say like, every time they play Civ, after they play it, they sort of enjoy it while they're playing it, but after they play it, they feel like they wasted their time. And I remember specifically noticing with Dishonored, I would spend half a day on one mission. And at the end of it, I wouldn't feel like I wasted my time. I felt like, God, that was a great morning. Mm. I just had a great time. And I don't know what it is about this, but like, yeah, I don't feel like I wasted my time. I feel like it was interesting.
I think there's also the desire to savor it as well, because it's great that this game is what it is, but feels so rare. Like, even though we've had a good track of single player games, like, I was sort of had that thing of wanting to have my first reactive, narratively coherent playthrough. So not mining it out too much. And I think actually that's one of the things that redeemed that saved that experience for me is that every time I went through an area in any part of the game, I knew that I was going to return to this because I know how many times I played the first game. Like, I knew that there would be more stuff for me to discover and that friends would tell me, oh, this weird thing you can do. And so I was sort of happy to not stop and, because I did try and find all the bone charms and I did try and explore quite a lot. But if I felt that like going a particular direction was like against the spirit of the playthrough I was having, I felt okay going, I don't do that particular side quest this time around. Like a good example is, okay, so yeah, mission 4, the streets before the Clockwork Mansion, that was the first time I realized that you can, rob the black market shops, which I'm 90% sure they nicked from Spelunky.
Is that the one, where you've come across two people who've placed two whale oil barrels?
Or they need a third one.
They're saying they need a third. Yeah, I really loved that one because that was, the first time I knew that as well. And in fact, for my first playthrough, I thought that was the only time you could rob black market. I didn't know there's any other way to do it. And you hear them saying, one of them's yelling at the other to say like, two barrels is not enough. We can't do this. Like, we need a third. And I took them both out and then there was two whale oil barrels next to like what looks like a weakened brick wall. So I shot it and they didn't blow up the wall. And my instinctive gamer instinct was like, oh, okay, weakened brick walls can't be destroyed by whale oil barrels. And then my other like narrative brain kicked in and said, they just said that you needed three to do this. I'm pretty sure there's a reason they said that.
That was, so this was the mission that I first got, Shadow Walk. So the tentacle monster stealth form, which
I never got that my first playthrough.
Really? So like those were the two powers, Domino and that, apart from Far Reach, obviously, were the two powers I used the most. Huh. Because I mean, I love Shadow Walk because it feels horrific, but the non-lethal version is also horrible, but like, you sort of like pull something out of them or put something into their mouth. It's unclear exactly what you're doing to them.
When you do a lethal playthrough, it's very clear what you're doing. You rip them in half.
I did rip some people in half. Don't worry about that. That's not happened. But like, I always felt that like that was my sort of like Wrath of God form. Like I'm still going like, you know, that it was still, you know, Emily's still sort of the problem solver. But those two people, like, in my head, I was using that whenever it was like, I didn't want there to be like any explanation for what just happened. So like, I'd seen those two people. So I dominoed them together and then waited for them to walk around the corner and then sort of smoke form, grab one of them, pull her down, choke her out. And the other one's like, what the fuck is going on? But when they wake up, they're going to have they're not going to go, I think we were just choked out by the Empress of the Isles. Like that.
An improbable story. Like,
they will have a story to tell that's as convoluted as the first season of Lost, pretty much. Like, mysterious.
A smoke monster. Something weird that we can't explain.
So yeah, that streets area was like, not like messy, but like, there's like the ambush. It's the first time you're ambushed by the Howlers as well. Like there's a back street where there's like, this happens a few times in the game. There's a woman saying like, help, help. You get jumped.
I feel like that went wrong for me in a kind of like scripting sense in that so it's the back of a station and you don't need to go out there. And if you're in the station, you can already leave to get to the Clockwork Mansion. If I open that door at all, I would simultaneously hear the woman say, you there, please, I need your help. And also be detected by four different people. They would all, like, without even having line of sight, they would all go like, detected, and then rush towards me. And so every time I opened it, I was like, what the fuck is happening here? It felt like there was some scripted sequence that was supposed to happen that never did for me.
Right, it worked okay for me. Like, that was the first section I found myself, like, really, because most of the time, like, with stealth, you kind of can see these situations before they happen, whereas that was, like, a genuine, like, oh, shit. And it was the first time I've done, like, mass non-lethal takedown, like a mass non-lethal solution when I've already been spotted, which involved like Far Reach vaulting myself onto a rooftop, running until they didn't know where I was, dominoing a bunch of them, drop, taking down the other one until there's only one left, and then like parry, neck jab, spin them around, choke them out, which felt really like, again, just a, you know, a cool solution to that problem, but again, those people are going to wake up with no fucking idea what just happened.
On my first playthrough, I just learned not to open that door. Every time I opened that door, everyone detected me and I didn't know why.
Oh, were you going through the door from the station?
Yeah.
I think that's probably why, because the one of the guys is hidden directly to your left as you come through that door.
Right.
Whereas if you come from the alleyway, which is probably the way you'd go in if you'd never been in the station, because if you've been in the station, you could probably just leave that area. If you go in the alleyway, they do, I think, wait until you've gone over to help and then they jump you.
Yeah. So my first playthrough, I just learned not to open that door and I just went on with my life. And then, on my next playthrough, I knew that was going to happen. And so I kind of like, actually, for whatever reason, I ended up on the roof of that station. I was, just taking a different route in, and I really love that you can get up there. And once you go over the roof of the station, you can see down at the back end and you can see the situation. There's someone standing right in the middle of that courtyard. And then, I could see someone hiding around the corner. And it was funny because I was like, okay, they're setting up an ambush and these people are hiding. And so I took out those two people and then like dropped down to kill the third one and then discovered like, oh shit, there are two more people who are also hidden and they attack me. And so like I would keep reloading and keep taking out more and more of the hidden people. And even after taking like four of the hidden people, there's a fifth hidden person who would still attack me. And it took me a long time to like figure out where they all are.
That is one area where the heart, again, is a help.
All right.
It's not specific lines, but it has lines for howlers and gangsters. And if you point it at someone, it's like, this person literally joined the howlers when they were being chased out of home or something like that. And, you know, it gives you a tip off. I think the only other thing that I really liked about that area, like there's like the upper town, like the posh, more high security area before you get to the mansion itself, you got to do some more stuff.
Yeah.
There's like a posh household, which actually has people in it. Most of the houses are deserted, but there's like a lord and a lady and a maid in one of those buildings and like having a conversation about all the shit that's happening. And, I wanted to steal their things, broadly speaking. And that was like one of the other times that I used Shadow Walk. And so it actually felt like horrific because I ended up like dominoing, I think the aristocrat and the two aristocrats together. And choking out one of them. And I didn't realize that the maid could see one of the other ones. So she like immediately panicked after the one that was on the sofa kind of collapsed and she started to run. So I just chased her in shadow form and then like sort of dragged her down and like did the tentacle stuff.
Never a good sentence to find yourself saying.
No, indeed. But you know, in a sort of, and it was like, I'm robbing your house and I'm for the best possible reasons, but this was horrific. Like, what was your first experience of the Clockwork Mansion like? Cause it's probably the level that I feel like I saw the least of.
I had an experience that I got really into eventually and I didn't realize how good it was until I talked to other people about it because I walked into the lobby and Jindosh says, the first time you pull a lever, I at the time I didn't register this what triggered it, but you pull a lever and then someone says, Jindosh says, someone is using my clockwork levers or whatever. Come up and I'll give you a formal welcome or whatever. And at the time he says that, you're at the bottom, there's two staircases that appear and a clockwork soldier appears in front of you and there's a door behind the clockwork soldier. So immediately my rebellious instinct kicks in, like, I'm going through that fucking door. I don't care what this clockwork soldier has to say about it. And, I guess this overrode even my stealth instinct, because I don't think I found a way to do it without the clockwork soldier seeing me, so I just kind of sprinted past the clockwork soldier. And I don't know when this exactly clicked with me, but at some point I sort of decided I didn't like Jindosh. I hated his endless, I call it Tannoy taunting, the thing that the Joker does to you in Arkham Asylum all the fucking time.
Or Sander Cohen in Bioshock.
Yeah.
Frolic.
I don't remember it bothering me in Bioshock, but in general in games, sort of the VO that is just there to tell you, I noticed you did X. Here's my line about X. Always feels transparently gamey to me. And it's possible to get around it with great writing, but I didn't feel that had happened. And, it was a combination of like, that pissed me off. So that put me in the gear of like, I hate Jindosh. Jindosh is my enemy and I want him to suffer. And then I decided, I don't know when this clicked with me, but I sort of noticed that he didn't know who I was. He would.
Did you not have the conversation with?
No.
Okay. So
never saw him, yeah. And he never saw me. And he makes a lot of lines about like, because he comments on your progress. And wants to say how far you've got, basically. And it sometimes you say you've got very far. Sometimes you say, oh, you were close a minute ago, but now you've gone back on yourself. And a lot of the times that he would comment on how far I got, he would say, I don't know who you are, but no one's ever got this far before, or things like that. And I sort of latched onto that, and I decided like, it's good that you don't know who I am, and you're going to die not knowing who I am, and you're going to hear me destroy every one of your Clockwork Soldiers.
They're very expensive.
That was, yeah, another thing I latched onto. Like, I destroyed one. He said something like, oh, you've destroyed one, but I'm sure the others will get you. And then he destroyed the second one. He's like, those are expensive, you know. And then he destroyed the third one. He's like, I'm beginning to hate the sound of these being destroyed. And so I sort of like latched onto that. I was like, okay, you don't like this. I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to destroy every single one of them. And also the fact that you don't know who I am, that's going to stay true. And you're just going to hear me destroy every single one of your Clockwork Soldiers. And then you're going to die never knowing who killed you. And that was, like I said before, like, a lot of my playstyle is informed by not who I want to be, but who I want the enemies to think I am. Mm. I just think about their psychology and what they're going through. And they are people who've robbed me of my power, and they've taken me off my throne and everything. And so I want their experience to be as confusing and terrifying as possible. And so for Jendash, it was a case of like, everything he's created is going to be picked apart bit by bit until he just suddenly dies. And when I actually got to him in the end, I realized, by that point, I discovered that you can rewire the Clockwork Soldiers. And I'm like, okay, two great things happened. One was that I realized, even though I'm doing a mostly non-lethal playthrough, there is a Tesla coil in that, or whatever it's called.
Arc pylon,
which I loved in Dishonored 1. And, I love Walls of Light as well. And that is a Sokolov technology. And Jindosh has a rival with Sokolov. He's kidnapped him, obviously. And he both respects and envies his genius. And he wants to think that he's better than Sokolov. But Sokolov's kind of my guy. And Jindosh is not my guy.
Yeah.
dickhead, another way of putting it. And so he's an intellectual rivalry. And like one of the ways to sort of, he's a mastermind and he's a genius and everything. But, one of the ways to like dig at a genius is to imply that someone else is better than him. And so not only did I destroy most of his Clockwork Soldiers, but I destroyed them with Sokolov's Arc Pylon, which Jindosh specifically says is like, it's just a relic from his bygone era. Obviously my technology is better, but, I rewired the Arc Pylon. Actually, I didn't intend to do that. It was just that when I depowered it, there was a bug that meant it was still powered, so it would still kill me. So I had to rewire it in order to get through that room. It just had to happen. And once I did, I realized, oh shit, like one of the cool things about Clockwork Soldiers is that in general, like non-human enemies, I'm always a bit skeptical of because that's a lot of the things that that go along with humans are what makes emergent gameplay cool, is, you know, figuring out what they're going to notice and what they're not going to notice. But Clockwork Soldiers, I realized, if you're playing a non-lethal playthrough, it's like an excuse to use all these cool systems about electrocuting and wall of lighting people.
Sword fighting as well. Like you can fight them and chop their arms off.
So I decided like, normally I don't get to put people through a wall of light or kill them with an arc pylon. But particularly because an arc pylon is a Sokolov technology, I'm going to kill as many Clockwork Soldiers as possible with his arc pylon. I'm going to rewire it, and then just every time a Clockwork Soldier sees me, I'm just going to run all the way back to the arc pylon. And if they lose me, I'll run back to them and say, hey, I'm here! And then run to the arc pylon. So I killed like five of them with the arc pylon. And then I think there was two of them guarding him for me, once I got to him in the end. And one of them I lured away and killed him with a wall of light. And then the other one, I went back and I decided I figured out a way to get into the elevator and get up sort of to the side of his patrol route, and decided I'm just going to rewire him. And so the way Jindosh dies is one of his own, like almost all of his own creations are killed by someone he has no idea who they are, and then the last one just turns on him and guts him. And I wanted like his last moment to be like, what the fuck is happening? Like, why?
So I had a extremely different experience of that mission, because Jindosh said nothing to me at all. Under any circumstances.
Oh, you did that the only first time through?
Yeah.
Oh, well done.
I slid under the cabinet as it descended into the ground in the first room after I pulled the lever. And
so you did pull the lever?
So you pull the lever, but then, like, you're surrounded by, like, museum stuff, right? Like, there's, like, all these display cabinets of inventions and things. And I'll admit to not being wholly original in this because, like, When I went to visit Arcane in April, they showed like a tiny amount of the Clockwork Mansion just as a kind of little tease of like, and this is what else is in the game. Yeah. And during an interview, I think with, Dinga Bakabo, who's like the lead gameplay designer, he said like, we've had playtesters do some crazy things like get inside the Clockwork Mansion. And that is basically, I think, all I knew, but that phrase was like, So essentially like, I still had to sort of wing it quite a lot, but basically what happened was, when I first pulled the lever, there was a display cabinet in front of me with some stuff in it. And it sort of fit my interpretation of Emily, that her reaction to this happening is going to be like, fuck, get the fuck out of the way. So I ended up doing like a butt slide underneath this cabinet, because the cabinet is on like a little piece of floor that vanishes into the ground. So me and the cabinet ended up going underground. Into a gray, almost like portal behind the scenes sort of level side, like bit of level geometry. And Jindosh comes on the tannoy and says, aha, I see someone's up. Oh, it must have malfunctioned because he can't see anybody.
Oh, wow.
So he goes like, oh, I guess the house is malfunctioning.
Oh, that's so cool.
And then he doesn't speak to you at all because he doesn't know you're there.
Right. So I saw that later on, I saw there's an achievement for Jindosh never knowing you're there. And I thought I'd already done pretty well with him never knowing who I am.
No, it means he never really knew there was anyone in the house here.
So when I saw that achievement, I was like, how do you even do that? Because I, like, he was always talking about his floor sensors and his audio sensors and like, oh, do you have to be in stealth mode the whole time? And then my second playthrough, I was like, okay, I want to get that achievement. Not for the achievement. I just want to kill Jindosh without him ever knowing I'm there. And I want him to shut up. As soon as I press the first lever, that's when he says, ah, I see someone's using my clockwork things. So my interpretation was, oh, you can't press any levers. And so there is a way to do it without pressing any levers. And
there is. I've seen you go through the skylight, right?
Yeah. You can shoot that out. And so I did that and, it was brilliant. I loved that second playthrough. I was figuring out, like, I'm just never going to touch your stupid fucking machines. Yeah. Whatever it is you have in mind for me, I'm not going to play into it. And I'm just going to go through the back alleys and the vents and stuff. Yeah, it was incredibly satisfying to like creep out on at his desk, because when I played it the other way, he was kind of roaming around his whole lab and he was walking all over the place, and so were his clockwork soldiers, and it was very hard to avoid. And if he never knows you're there, not only does he never say anything, but he's also just sitting at his desk working on whatever he's working on, and you just get to sneak up on him and just kill him out of the blue, and that was even more satisfying. But then I heard from our friend Alex Wiltshire, he did do the thing where when he says like, come up to my lobby or whatever, Alex did go up there and you meet him. And
he's, you do, yeah. I've seen that on a different playthrough. You have a conversation with him.
And like, he has a whole different set of barks for if he knows you're Emily Cauldron. Like, because when you meet him there, he's a smart guy and he figures out exactly who you are, even though you're wearing your completely camouflaged scarf.
A scarf that probably has your royal crest on it or something.
I love the line really early on about like, she's sort of explaining why she needs to disguise herself. Like, my face is on like half the coins in the city. Like, not only do people know who you are, like literally the money of this society has your face on it.
But yeah, so I ended up in the walls and didn't get any of the barks, which meant that everything I knew about Kieran Jindosh, I found out from the voice, like the audio recordings and some of the text you find. You find out him being sort of like a genius student at the academy, but kind of a bit arrogant. But the main thing that came across to me, and this is definitely the point in the game where I started to actually feel real sympathy for a lot of the baddies. And the main thing that came across to me is that Kieran isn't really that involved. Like, compared to a lot, like, that's one thing that really stood out to me about Dishonored 2 at the start, right? So your first assassination target is the conspirator guy in Dunwall Tower, and he's a prick and you can dispose of him in a bunch of different ways. Yeah. But he's a sort of lower order of asshole, right, compared to a lot of the other villains. And like a lot of Dishonored 1's characters, you're not finding audio diaries of him like ordering more prostitutes to murder in his private chambers, which is sort of like a running theme of the first game or whatever. Then Alexandria Hypatia is explicitly a good person in a terrible situation, and killing her is actually pretty brutal, right? Like, that's a pretty ruthless thing to do. And with Kieran Jindosh, I got the impression like, this guy is kind of a dickhead, but if the world would, but otherwise, he doesn't feel like he'd necessarily be evil of his own account. Like, he's making this technology, but like, Sokolov is, I'm there to rescue him, and he's built worse things and done far worse things.
Which are used by the same organizations.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, you know, if you're going to talk about enabling awful dictatorships, then no one here is innocent. So as I was going through the mansion, I was resolving like, okay, whatever the way of just getting this guy out of the picture. Like, in my sort of like, so in my player brain, I was like, I don't think this guy deserves it. And in my role play Emily brain, it was like, this guy's useful, right? I'm the Empress, right? Like, I kind of want this guy around. Like, I want his expertise. I just don't want him serving these people. Mm. Like, the Duke is the real problem. Delilah is the real problem. And the fact that he's skeptical about the magic stuff and he doesn't really, like, trust it. And there's some references to Brianna Ashworth, who's the next target. Mm. And he's not really sure about, you know, that stuff. And he's providing the soldiers, but his own stake in the, like, it sort of says, like, it's a lot of stuff to see. He's trying to be great. He wants greatness. But he's, you know, misguided. And none of that made me think, like, fuck, okay, this prick's going to die. Because he wasn't talking to me at all. So I, yeah. I wasn't goaded by him. So I got, and I found the things you need to find out for the chair he's been using on Sokolov, which is probably the nastiest thing he's been doing.
Yep.
Is like trying to, and so this is this is one of the first things I was like, I want to do a spoiler cast. So this is a moment I really wanted to talk about because, they sort of set it up as he's got this sort of, you know, steampunk Tesla chair in his lab that he's been trying to use to essentially like erase the free will center of Sokolov's brain so mm-hmm. that Sokolov will do whatever he wants. And if you are able to disable his clockwork soldiers and knock him out. So when I finally found him, he did actually sort of see me because I blew up both his clockwork soldiers, then parried his sword, hit him in the throat, choked him out, and stuck him in the chair. And the idea is that you can like, and initially it sounds like a sci-fi thing. It sounds like a sci-fi fantasy Dishonored solution, which is that you kind of destroy his genius and you prevent him from being a threat in that way. And I did that and it's fucking heartbreaking. It's horrible. Like,
yeah,
like it's a bit like in the first game, Lady Boyle's Party, where you condemn her, knock her out and leave her in a boat with a guy who wants to, you know,
that was always the one where like, maybe she would have been better off dead.
Yeah. So you put Kieran Dindrush in the chair and then it was then that I realized like, shit, it's not a magic steampunk sci-fi thing. You just give him brain damage. Mm. You give him really severe brain damage. And as you keep talking to him, he, you know, sort of oscillates between, he's furious and he doesn't know why. And he tries to, and there's a bit of him just trying to remember how a battery works and he can't. And it's heartbreaking. He's like, you put acid on the copper and I don't know why. And then he, so it drifts into a sort of like happy stupor where he's like, maybe there'll be soup. And then if you use the heart on him, then the heart like breaks your heart. Like it's cause she just says like, he's going like, it's lines like, he'll spend his days in the, you know, the sanitarium or something or the care house, right? Yeah. He'll always feel like he's forgotten something and he'll never know why and he'll never forgive you for it. And I was literally like, oh God, I felt fucking terrible. Like I didn't deserve like the power I had.
Yeah.
So I shot him in the heart.
After
in the chair. Yeah. Right, like I just put a crossbow bolt in his heart. Cause it felt like the most humane thing to do. It's like, I literally can't live with this.
Yeah.
Like I wish he'd been able to die as a villain. You know what I mean? Like, the experience you had of like taking down the bragging villain at the end of the clockwork trap mansion for me was like, I just gave someone brain damage and then mercy killed them.
I'm pretty sure I've done, you know, two full playthroughs and both times I've just killed him. And I've heard about the non-lethal option and it's always sounded pretty disturbing. Now that you describe it, I realize if I had done it, I would have done the same as you. I think I would have killed him afterwards because, I think it would have been too much because you have a friend of the family, is a avid, she loves horses and she keeps horses and she has two horses that she loves. And one day she was feeding a horse with a metal bucket that was on the horse's nose and the horse suddenly looked up. And that hit her in the head with a metal bucket hard enough that she just lost her memory. And
Jesus.
She, I don't know, it wasn't as simple as like amnesia or it wasn't as simple as short term versus long term. It was just certain memories have gone. And it was, a thing where if she wanted a cup of coffee, she would go to the kettle and she would go to the jar of coffee and she would go to the mug. And those three ingredients would be in front of her, but she wouldn't know how to combine them. She wouldn't know how those things relate to each other. and that it almost sounds too real.
I've had
the ingredients, but not knowing what to do with them.
Again, like without too much detail, say I have like a close family member who has had extensive electroshock therapy due to like past trauma, and that is not a precision approach to changing someone's memories. Yeah. You lose a lot with the stuff that you want somebody to be able to forget, and it's not an elegant or, you know, it's not something you would wish on anybody. And obviously, like high fantasy murder is a step beyond that still. But that was the first moment in the game for me where I felt really like really uncomfortable, but in a quite a good way actually, because in a way that ultimately enhanced my experience of the game, because it made me think a lot more about what I was doing.
I feel like there's definitely there is the game almost. That's at times, from some perspectives, seems to suggest that it is a game where you decide ahead of time, I'm going to be a non-lethal person or I'm going to be a lethal person. And if you're going to be a non-lethal person, you must do the non-lethal option at every juncture. And Dishonored 1, I think, only once kind of hinted at the idea that, that the non-lethal might not be as good as the lethal, or, you know, it might not be the charitable option with the Lady Boyle mission. And the rest of the time, it usually was, I think, as far as I remember. And Dishonored 2, it feels much more case by case. There's a whole, like, Hypatia is just, to kill her is kind of crazy. Like,
if you can do anything else, yeah.
If you can avoid it, it seems crazy to kill her. Dindos, almost feels like it's crazy to do the non-lethal option, which is, like, weird to say, but it's,
if I could have locked him in a room till the whole thing was dealt with, I totally would have done.
Actually, so to some extent, it's good that you do it case by case. Like, it sort of, you know, if you're going to make a game like this, it's better that people take it on the merits of the individual situation than that they stick to a playstyle universally. But I couldn't help thinking of, like, when you find Sokolov in the first game, you just take him back to the place where you live and you lock him in a room. Because that's how you deal with people you don't want to kill.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help thinking, like, we have a ship. Like, it's not the best prison in the world, but we can lock rooms. There are locked rooms aboard the ship. We could just take Jindosh and put him in a room somewhere.
I guess we already had to take Sokolov, and it's like maybe two people is too many to carry.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I mean, so, like, I guess the perfect Dishonored 5 version of this, where we live in a fantasy world where we can do far more ambitious things with game design, is probably the one way, because... If you think about it, the design space for how you kill someone is enormously open, because it's a very final end state that the game doesn't have to account for very many variations of. Whereas variation how you non-lethally remove someone from the equation is far less easy to do dynamically.
Yeah.
Which is why killing targets, you've got a billion different ways you can try and do that. But there is always the non-lethal way. Yeah. And I think maybe the next sort of generational leap in the design of these games would be to have both. Be open to you. So an example would be, in this situation, the super hard thing to do would be to take unconscious Jindosh to Sokolov's cell, lock him in there, and rewire the soldier outside to be on your side.
Yeah.
So that he's then trapped in his own little maze, can't get out, and you swap the prisoners.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, maybe that could have been the non-lethal, like the fixed non-lethal solution to that level that wouldn't have been so cruel. But, you know, the perfect version of the game is where you can sort of jury rig something like that.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, or find another way.
I remember, so in Deus Ex 1, one of the sort of key choices in that is, whether you assassinate, there's one dude whose name I forget right at this moment, but it's the key moment where, like, you're, evil government overlords send you to assassinate this terrorist leader.
Oh yeah.
And when you talk to him, he's not so bad. And if you don't kill him, then Anna Navarra runs in and she kills him for you. And your only other option is you can kill Anna Navarra. And if you kill her before she kills him, then he's still alive. But there isn't really another option for, like, the rest of the plot. He's still going to sort of be irrelevant at some point. Either he's going to be arrested or die. But I remember one time I sort of planted prox grenades so that as soon as Anna Navarra ran in, she would die. And I didn't kill him, and so she did run in, and she did die, and so he's still left alive. And so then I knocked him out, and then I picked him up. I knew he was going to die if he stays aboard this plane, because it's surrounded by UNATCO, and they're going to kill him. But I thought, like, well, I'm still in control of this game world, and he's just an NPC, and NPCs can always be knocked out, and NPCs can always be carried, and carried NPCs can be taken anywhere. So I just picked him up, and I, like, walked him out of the plane and past all the UNATCO guards and then went into like a sewer or something and just found this really remote place to just drop him down so that one day he will wake up and he...
You're free now, lassie.
Yeah, exactly. And of course the game doesn't support that. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't help the game. He still counts as being basically subdued or arrested or whatever. But just, yeah, that idea of like, if this guy is really important and he's a character in the game world that I can manipulate with all these systems that you've given me, I should be able to manipulate him in the ways...
That would be the logical, like... Yeah, that'd be, it's the next step, I guess, for stuff like this.
It also never really rang true to me that, like, Sokolov, who is, like, Leonardo da Vinci of this world, couldn't figure out the planks that are on the button.
I guess it's the death robot more than the planks.
Yeah, but even so, I feel like he's clever enough that he could dodge the death robot on the planks. If I can, he probably can.
Maybe.
Like, I'm better at combat for sure. If it was a sword fight, I totally buy that he wouldn't get out and I could. But if it's a logic puzzle, I feel like he's probably smarter than me.
Yeah, it is a wacky ass prison. But yeah, and that sort of brings me to so this was like the most morally complicated side of the game for me. This mission and the one that follows it, which is the Royal Conservatory where you go to track down Brianna Ashworth. Mm. And I really want to talk about Brianna Ashworth because this was the point where I was really glad I was playing as Emily. And also I thought morally one of the most complicated parts of the game.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you heard the same thing, but. So Brianna Ashworth is the witch and she's sort of Delilah's chief lieutenant. And she has her own sort of coven of witches who have taken over this old sort of natural history museum.
Yeah.
Kind of, which is, it's an amazing environment.
It's so much the Natural History Museum that I keep calling it the Natural History Museum, even though it's called the Royal Conservatory.
Yeah, it is the London Natural History Museum with more owls.
great owls too.
Fantastic
amazing owls.
And so in the Brigmore Witches, in the DLC for the first game, there are the witches and there are the implications of like why they become witches and what they're interested in. But it's only sort of shades of it because you only see them quite briefly and they're often quite hostile or presented in a sort of scary way. There's one thing that can happen in the end of Brigmore Witches is there's one witch that doesn't like Delilah and doesn't like what Delilah's trying to do. So she will give you some help. If you promise not to hurt any of the other witches. But it doesn't necessarily go very deep on them. And one thing that's interesting about Dishonored, and I love this about the way the writing has changed and about the way the plot is framed, is Dishonored is not a world where, men or women have magic any differently to each other, right? Like, there are men who use magic, there are women who use magic. The magic always comes from the same place, which is the Outsider's Mark, which is given to people, apparently, relatively even-handedly, because there's four people we know of who've had it, and it's two women and two men at this point. So, Delilah, Emily, Dowd, and Corvo. So that sort of raises the question, like, why witches? Why are there all these female covens of witches in a world where the mechanics of magic aren't themselves have anything to do with gender.
Yeah.
And the answer the game implies is because this is a sexist society. And for a lot of these women, like magic and Delilah and her coven is a way out of a really shitty life. And that's explicitly the case for Brianna Ashworth, who Delilah was her escape from an arranged marriage. And it's sort of implied to be the case for a lot of the other witches as well. And if you just watch them, they are kind of in there, like moving around the levels. They're quite unlike, well, there's enough examples of them being quite unlike other guards because they don't hang around. Like they don't patrol like paid guards. Two of them are just having a picnic on a big owl. Like they're just sat hanging out and talking. And that, you know, the inside of that museum is in complete disarray. But the idea is that this is kind of where they live. Like this is not like. It's a sanctuary for them from.
Yeah, I was confused by this because, I got very interested in Brianna and I sort of, like read up on everything I could find on her. But it seemed to me that she was the curator of the Royal Conservatory, not just now, but for a long time. Like she was, she is even in the past when you eventually, you know, go back and see her original meeting with Delilah. And she is just, she's not like someone who barged in and took over the Royal Conservatory. She's literally the sort of the person who runs it. But when you go to the Royal Conservatory, it feels like a place that's just been wrecked by a bunch of vandals. Like, it's all smashed up, and things, there's a lot of corpses around, and a lot of like display cases that are smashed, and it feels like a place that's just been vandalized by a bunch of witches who barged in, and yet they are all loyal to Brianna, who is sort of the owner of the place. Mm. So I couldn't figure out, is this a place that was previously run in a sort of civilian way and was just recently taken over, or is it Brianna ran it until at some point, like when her coven joined her, they all smashed the place up? Why did the place smash up?
I think presumably it's when, because it's implied that she's been a witch for a long time. She's been a follower of Delilah for a long time, because kind of that's what Delilah does, is kind of create followers around her and give them her power. And I think my sort of reading of it was that they sort of treated this place as a sanctuary, and those sort of like overgrown ruins is just sort of like a motif of witches as they appear in, in Brigmore Witches as well. But that like the place went into disarray and became more of like the coven sanctuary than a working museum at the moment when they went full in on the plot, right? Like it's on the building of the Oraculum and that scheme that they're enacting in there is probably like when the place sort of went. That's my reading of it. Maybe it doesn't quite gel with how dilapidated it is, but it didn't feel like it had been sort of invaded to me. It was more like it had been sort of, it'd become this sort of sanctuary.
Right.
And like, I think that's a genuinely, like, I want to read more about that. And, you know, it's the kind of side of the reframing of the story that I thought was genuinely really impressive, because like Delilah is not an unsympathetic character, and explicitly her backstory is, you know, this sort of illegitimate daughter of your grandfather, like the emperor, that reframes Jessamine, you know, Emily's mother, as kind of a shitty kid because she was the legitimate one, and that magic and the outsider's mark, like kind of explicitly what the outsider does is kind of apparently occasionally empowered, disempowered people to sort of create chaos, right? If you can say if he's for anything, it's kind of what he does. Is sort of inject this sort of, inject power from nowhere. But Dishonored is a lot about socio-political systems and who has power in society versus who doesn't. And often it's kind of a big and cartoonish thing, like a fascist dictator over a city with all this kind of crazy technology. And the previous level is all about the technology that's used to impose that kind of power in one very explicit way. Whereas, like the outsider's magic is sort of like this sort of force for anarchy. Like it comes in from nowhere and empowers people. And Delilah has actually used it in, obviously she's not a fully sympathetic character and she does some terrible things, but that little society she's created, despite everything they're trying to do and maybe the people they've killed, you've killed a lot of people as well. Like no one is good in Dishonored. And I found myself like as a player sort of bit heartbroken that I had to break it. Because, you know, Delilah is like, you know, a woman who's been through terrible shit, who's got this power that she's passed on to other women and in order to free them from a really shitty society. And they've created this coven. And actually their plan in that light is really interesting, because their plan is to corrupt the Sisters of the Oracular Order, who are...
And they influence the overseers.
So essentially to subvert like the explicitly patriarchal kind of religious order from within. So-
Was there stuff that you sort of like, discovered that was about these women deciding to become part of this order because of the sexism?
Brianna explicitly, because it's how she escapes from an arranged marriage.
Right. Yeah.
So that feels to me like how she gets away from like, I mean, that, but also it felt like, you know, if you look at that society as depicted in Dishonored, like, and looking at, you know, the one thing they've done to balance out in another way is that, you know, guards seem to be sort of relatively evenly male and female.
Yeah, so I was going to ask about this, because I definitely remember like 50-50 the officers being male versus female. But then the grunts, I think they were all male? I can't remember any female grunts.
I don't know. I don't want to commit to that because I can't remember one way
like
or another.
The ones in red who are sort of like the officers, I remember like lots of female officers, but I don't, like the guards, I remember male.
That's actually
guards.
A good point.
I don't know what that means.
So, you know,
true.
there's a lot of ways in which, like, you know, Dishonored society is a fantasy society and therefore is most progressive in the way that, like, historically 18th century Britain or whatever it's loosely based on wouldn't have been. Like, there being an empress who picks her own consort, and that's not really a huge issue.
Yeah, actually, a very interesting thing is, like, you know, Dishonored 1, it's never explicit that you are
Emily's father.
That you're sort of like, yeah, Emily's father, and, you know, or that you had any romantic relationship with the Empress. And then in Dishonored 2, it's totally assumed that you are, and it seems like everyone knows it. It's like not even a secret.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's maybe not necessarily a retcon, but sort of a shift. Although actually, did you notice that in some of the propaganda that as you're leaving Dunwall as either Emily or Corvo, Emily is referred to as Emily Atano, not Emily Caldwell. She gets given her father's name to delegitimize her.
All right.
So, you know, it's Empress Delilah Caldwell, yeah, okay. Emily Atano, so, which I thought was a nice touch. But yeah, but you know, the fabric of that society, like, it still has a lot of those sort of European aristocratic trappings. And like the Boyle sisters are another example of sort of like, you know, women whose power is exerted in a particular way, but can't be exerted in a whole bunch of other ways. And, you know, whichever the sisters is the conspirator in when it's randomly generated is sort of like working through the Lord Overseer and stuff like that. Mm. And so there's a theme in Dishonored that I don't really feel like I've got the right head on right now to go into in huge detail, but there's definitely a theme of like, how sort of disenfranchised and marginalized people get access to power in that world, and the outsider is one of them. But specifically, I think how, as it affects women is a really interesting theme because it's central to the witches and it's central to Delilah. Yeah. And it frames Emily very differently because Emily, like in that environment, when you are breaking, however you choose to approach it and however you take down that coven of witches, because if you do the non-lethal thing, which I did, and you rob Brianna of her powers and she's heartbroken, you also rob all the other witches of their power at the same time.
Yeah. Do they die?
They fall unconscious. Okay. So it depends. If the ones that are sitting on the owl, I think they die.
The reason I ask is because there was I was reading a bunch of like, guides to sort of weird, half cheats and half like weird glitches you might have seen. And one of them was like, oh, I randomly got the achievement for killing 6 people in half a second or whatever it is. And, it says, oh, if you activate the Oraculum, and there are that many witches left, they all die. So you all kill them all.
So I only had one of them die, and it was because she fell into a bloodfly nest when she fell unconscious. And I tested that. I went and saved because I wanted to see if that was actually happened. And that, I believe, is what happens. The rest of them were unconscious.
I can move
that. But that I don't know. I found that, again, really heartbreaking because if you go and speak to the statue of Delilah in Brianna's office, after that, you have a conversation with Delilah and she says, you know, you've destroyed something
beautiful. You have no right.
Yeah, you have no right. And I genuinely felt like Emily Caldwin, unwitting agent of the patriarchy. Like that was like the sort of, because I was here to restore all these old power structures and shut down this rebellion that, I mean, yeah, it's bad, but I was like, oh, fucking hell, is it worse than what?
Yeah. Now that I think about it, I think when I came back to Dunwall Tower, I did kill her witches, but in the conservatory, I didn't. I was still non-lethal at that point. So even though they were, I see Brianna as being the closest one to Delilah in terms of, allegiance. And so her people, I thought were pretty close to her, but yeah, I did actually just choke them out. I didn't actually kill anyone on that level. I did kill Brianna, Brianna herself. And again, it was a bit like the Jindos thing where the non-lethal option was almost as bad as killing her. And so it wasn't really a moral choice. It was more like I was very focused on what Delilah thought. And so the two things I did was like, this is actually, a moment where the game really came together for me in that I loved that level. I loved the visual look of it. You know, fascinating to explore. It was one of those, beautiful moments where Dishonored and Dishonored 2, at their best, they give you a building, not a level. And you feel like you can get into it from any way that you'd realistically be able to get into this building. And I came into it from a totally different way. I didn't go through the main entrance at all. I went through like this side thing across a cliff.
Yeah, did the same thing.
Okay. And, also because I didn't play the Brigmore Witches very much, I'd never encountered Gravehounds before. The first Gravehounds I ever encountered were at Brianna's side. So I'm like, I'm trying to assassinate this.
These are just dogs. Oh shit.
Yeah, so I this woman has a lot of protections because I had already, before I even encountered her, I read the thing that says what bone charms she has, which is brilliant, by the way. I love that. And that was very Shadow of Mordor. Wait, is that the name of that game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Presumably you mean the one with orcs.
Yes. And in that game, you discover, if you're going to assassinate someone, you first get intel on them, and you find out, oh, they're immune to ranged attacks, or they're immune to melee attacks, they're immune to this kind of thing, and so I must do some other kind of thing. And Brianna, I think, is the only one in the game where, like, you can find a note that says, oh, she has a bone charm that makes her immune to the first ranged attack she gets. Like, whatever you fire at her, it'll turn to blood flies. And anything you summon will turn to her side. At the time, that was irrelevant to me, because I didn't have anything I could summon, and I wasn't going to shoot her anyway. But it was great to, like, know that, and, like, okay, if I stab her, I'll be fine. If I shoot her with a gun, I'm going to be fucked. And then, yeah, there's these two dogs in front of her. I've never seen anything like them before. They're like dogs, but they're kind of on green fire. And the first thing I ever did, like, to try and take her down was, I knew they were dogs. I knew they were going to attack me, and I was still trying to do it without, like, being detected too much. And so I threw a grenade at them. I, like, held the grenade until it was almost cooked and threw it at them at a time when, I must have already tried it once, because I think I already knew this wasn't going to kill them permanently. I was just trying to cause so much chaos that when I dropped on her head, she would be utterly baffled by this. Like, she would be looking at her dogs exploding in front of her, and at that point, I would slit her throat. And that was my plan. And I did that, and it worked, actually. Like, the dogs, I didn't know how they worked at all, so all I could figure out was that everything I did to them didn't work. Like, I would shoot them with, like, an arrow, and that didn't kill them. I would shoot them with a flame bolt, that didn't kill them. I would shoot them with, like, a trank dart, that didn't kill them. And it turned out that was because they are things that, when they die, when they actually come back, if you don't destroy their skull. Oh, I didn't know that. And so I must have done that one encounter, like, you know, so many different times. And I was just desperately trying to do it in a semi-stealthy way. And then I also saw that she was talking to Delilah in this weird statuegram type thing. I don't know what to call it. Like, the statuecom. And I, at one point, I'd sort of, like, I literally tried this like 25 times. And so one of those times I did it as an all-out combat while she was still talking to Delilah. And while I'm fighting her, Delilah starts to talk to you about it. Like, how dare you? You had no right. Or whatever. I guess I must have already killed her at that point. And I liked that, but then, like, I was torn between, I kind of want Delilah to know I killed her best friend, but I also really like the idea that Delilah has no idea what's happening. like I say, I'm always focused on what the enemies are thinking, and I really like the idea that when Delilah finally dies, she'll just be completely blindsided by it. Like, she just has no idea. And so I think that the way I finally did it was I very, very painstakingly kind of picked off the dogs. I really wanted the dogs to be dead before I ever attacked Brianna. And I did want to kill Brianna and not do the de-magicking. And so it was, I think I found some way to kill the first dog right in front of her without anyone detecting me. And they both ran upstairs to kind of find out what happened, because I was up there. And then I can kind of climb through a window, and there's actually, like, whale oil canisters up there. And I think that's how I did it, is, like, one of the last dog wandered near a whale oil canister, and I just shot that, and that just kills him and destroys his skull, and he can't resurrect. And then after both the dogs were killed, I just did a sort of, like, standard, I think, drop takedown on her and killed her. But yeah, I really loved that. Replaying that moment over and over again, both for mechanical reasons and for narrative reasons. Like, in any given playthrough, I could tell you, like, okay, narratively I was trying to do the right thing here, but mechanically it didn't work for this reason. Or I could say, like, okay, mechanically it did work out. I did what I was trying to do, and I did kill both the dogs, and I killed Brianna as well. But narratively, I later decided I didn't want to kill her, or, you know, I didn't want Delilah to see that I killed her. Like, I was torn between, like, I want her to see a friend die, but I also kind of like her being baffled by what's happening. And so that was, I think, at its best, the game's systems and narrative combine in such a way that gets me thinking about what I want to happen. It really makes me think about, like, what narrative goal do I want to achieve, and then what systems do I use to achieve that.
So I did entirely the non-lethal thing for the conservatory, because I came to sympathize. And one thing I really like about the writing of Low Chaos Emily is one thing she says a few times is,
like when this is all over, I'm going to make it better. Like it feels like you're shaping up the kind of empress she's going to be. And so I don't know if this is specific to what she was referring to, but my thought was like stripping these people of their magic is horrible, but it's not killing them. Like crucially, it's not killing them. And I had it in my head that like when I fixed this all and I've, you know, got my dad back and got my throne back, I'm changing this fucking society so that women who don't want to be arranged married don't have to become evil wizards, basically. you know, that was my thought. And that led to some fun, like my sort of, I did do a bit of experimenting with the stealth in this bit actually, because I wanted to, you don't actually have to, but it feels a bit wrong. Like if you just get the lenses and go straight to the Oraculum and use it, which is the non-lethal way of taking down, Brianna, it lets you do that even if the witches around you are still kind of up and about. It can kind of lead to some weird AI situations where they kind of see this happen. But I wanted to like clear the area around the Oraculum, and that includes a lot of witches that are sort of patrolling, and that's fine. But then it includes a couple who will sometimes just sit on the banisters and chat. Mm. And that's really problematic for Domino, because if they're dominoed and you take one of them down, the others will fall off the balcony to their death. Like I honestly think it's a very clever piece of the game design. I think that's why sometimes they will go and sit on a banister rather than just hang around. Cause if you're playing non-lethally, it creates moments where Domino, obviously you can't get behind them because they're sat on a banister.
Yeah.
But also Domino is a huge risk because they're sat on a banister.
I remember that, like there's two that sat on a chandelier and you can stand right behind them, and I dominoed them together and I just took one out and they both very gently lay down on the chandelier they're already on.
Those two are the ones I think I've been mistaken for the ones that were on the owl, because I was so sure they were on an owl. But maybe I was on an owl.
Yeah, I think they were just on a chandelier.
Okay, that's a chandelier. I was on an owl. That's the thing I'm trying to remember. I did try that, and I think I had some not success with them falling off, but I think I was also trank bolting them, so that might have been a difference.
Right.
Because I didn't want to get behind them in case that alerted them. But the way I ended up...
Yeah, I was surprised it didn't alert either of them when I did it.
The way I ended up doing that was dominoing them together and then casting Doppelganger on the landing next to them. So they would see the Doppelganger and like teleport off the chandelier to chase my Doppelganger. Wow. And then I had like the combat dart upgrade by this point. Mm. So sleep dart was instant. And then like picking one of them off and having the other one sort of top, like, you know, fall asleep.
That's really cool.
So that was like the kind of the cool systemic bit of that level. Cause after that, I depowered Brianna, but with this, you know, internal resolution of like, I actually kind of agree with the people in this room. Like, and I'm out.
I was thinking about, so I'm doing a Corvo playthrough where I want to be undetected for the whole thing. And I don't want to do a non-lethal playthrough anyway, but, it occurred to me, it seems like the non-lethal playthrough is incompatible with non-detected playthrough, right? Because the non-lethal things, you, like Jindosh and Brianna, I think, don't they both see you?
They both see you, yeah. So I think that's somewhat true of the first game as well.
Right.
That particularly...
Yeah, I never tried to do both
like, particularly if you don't want anyone to know what happened. Like, in the first game, it's completely incompatible with doing non-lethally. There are a few in the first game that you can do. Actually, even then, like the non-lethal takedown for the Lord Regent in the first game is stealing his audio tape where he confesses to everything
and
then broadcasting over the city Tannoy, which is a very good subversion of the evil man's Tannoy.
Yep.
Theme. At which point he gets arrested, but to do that, you have to have a conversation with the guy who normally operates the Tannoy.
Yep.
So yeah, I don't know. So yeah,
there's an achievement for completing the game without being spotted, and there's an achievement, I think, for completing the game without killing anyone, and I want to get one of those.
Yeah, it's Ghost and Clean Hands, which I think they're called.
I think I'll go for Ghost.
Yeah. But yeah, that was definitely like a point where I started to genuinely feel sympathetic for like most of the main villains in the game, like,
I think I didn't engage with the plot enough to sort of sympathize with the witches. I did hear the audio that Irish is talking about her arranged marriage and how she gets out of it, and obviously I approved of that. But for the rest of it, I think my main reaction to the witches was that they were cool.
Like, they are cool.
They just look awesome.
I don't know.
And there's something about, like, I don't know why this got to me, but like on the Dunwall Tower level, I was kind of like, I was mostly invested in killing them because I was really angry at Delilah and I wanted like all her people to die. But I also, like, I couldn't help being kind of charmed by I'm just like eating apples.
Yeah.
I'll just eat an apple.
there's something really
that's
like,
a person.
There's something really like, cool punk rock collective about the witches that I find.
That's what I like about them.
They're everyone punk. Else is kind of a stiff, right? Like, yeah. You've got your own boat full of kind of cool, broken punk rock people. But, like, you are like the ultimate establishment figure in that game, right? To a greater or lesser extent. And so, like, it feels a bit like, hello, fellow kids, to be like, oh, I'm a cool empress. Don't worry. I'm not like those other autocratic unelected leaders. I'm hip. I'm hip with the black magic.
I know they'd never do this, but the thing I kind of want from the plot is that, so the Empress died when you were very young, and she was a great Empress, and she like managed a society well, and Corvo is a great fighter, and you're a kid, and between the two of you, you don't really have the equipment to sort of like manage an empire that well.
Yeah, and Emily even says that at the start, right?
Like, yeah, so I would kind of love it if like, the reason you get thrown off your throne is not because of some magic lady who just has infinite power and is totally invincible, but just you get outplayed by the Duke. Like, he's just a better politician than you, and his armies are bigger, and he's just persuading more people to ally with him, and he just, overthrows you. And then you're in the situation where, like, shit, I failed at a political game because my mum wasn't around to help me with that. And so Corvo steps in and is like, well, you know, either I solve this for you, or you solve this for yourself, but either way, it's going to be by killing people. This is all I know. I don't know politics, but I know how to kill the five people who will stop this.
That's the hour-long pilot episode for the HBO version of Sonic. It totally is. Like that is, yeah, in the where you don't just get this over, you don't get the overthrow over with in the first 5 minutes of the game, but you actually spend an hour over it. Yeah.
I have a lot of problems with the voice acting. I find a lot of the performances very sort of overdone and hammy, but the two that I like are Emily, which is good because I was playing as Emily, and the Duke. I think the Duke is great.
Yeah, I really like the Duke.
He was like both convincing and funny. Like his Tannoy announcements in the streets are just like so ridiculous, but also like well judged in a way that it just makes him kind of.
I like that they picked a different. I mean, yeah, we should crack on because his mission is still like a mission away. But yeah, it's a different. It wasn't the character I was expecting for him because he's not the Lord Regent again. Because the Lord Regent is like a former spymaster and obviously like a Machiavellian figure, whereas like Luca is more explicitly like a fool. He's like a Nero kind of. Like, you know, he would have been content to rule poorly in decadence and be a shadow of his father who Corvo likes or liked and stuff like that, but sort of maybe be the most evil thing about him would be that he was completely incompetent had he not been sort of, well, maybe that's not true because he was killing a lot of people, but like he's sort of an incompetent conspirator is the thing. Like Delilah is the person who's got the plan and the brains and
his thing about the sea. That's just hilarious. It's just like, he just decides he hates the sea. Just the sea is evil and awful. And anyone who lives on the sea is just a terrible wretch. And you'll do anything you can to help them. And anyone who can avoid the sea should avoid the sea because he had a dream where the sea is evil. It's just amazing.
So the mission after a conservatory is the Dust District, which I completely skipped.
So you actually just skipped it?
Okay. 100% skipped it.
So I'm a puzzle guy, and this is very much my kind of thing, but I lost faith because I saw this thing, and even before I, like,
we should explain the context. I guess people will know because this is a spoiler.
Yeah, so you're in the Dust District, and you are trying to get to Aramis Sultan's mansion, and I was baffled by what was going on because you go to a building and there's a big combination lock in front of you and there's two people standing there talking about how they're going to try and crack the combination lock. And they just say, we can't do it. It just can't be done. And they give up and they walk away and you can try and talk to them, but they don't say anything to you. And then next to them, this is already confusing to me. There was a sort of like riddle dispenser and you use the riddle dispenser and it gives you a riddle. And the way it gives you a riddle makes it seem like to me like they hadn't given the riddle to those people. But the game is really, in multiple ways, it sort of telegraphs to you that you can't solve this riddle. And first of all, there's two people coming up to you and saying you can't solve this riddle.
And Sokolov says it's impossible and he's like the, epoch-defining genius.
Yeah. And you get this riddle and I just looked at it and thought,
it's solvable.
It has a lot of things in it that sound ambiguous and there are a lot of assumptions you'd have to make, but I still feel like this is maybe solvable. And so I was just very interested in solving it. And so I didn't print anything out, but I wrote out on a piece of paper. First, I wrote it in a text document, which was doomed. And I realized that way to solve this puzzle, you've got to have things that you can move around on a sort of
surface. I did exactly this.
Okay. So I tried writing a text document where like you're told something about like, a bunch of women who will go to a dinner party and they're wearing various colors and they're drinking various drinks and they have various heirlooms and your ultimate task is to pair the heirlooms to the people. And in trying to kind of write down the information I had in a text document, it got wildly complicated and I couldn't do it. And I realized this would be much easier if I had these on pieces of paper that I could move around on a surface. And so I did that. And I basically did everything right. I kind of like approached it from the right perspective. It's a much more advanced logic puzzle than you would ever normally solve in a game like this. Usually it's, like in Mass Effect, it's Towers of Hanoi, right? Literally the Towers of Hanoi puzzle is in, is it Mass Effect 2 or Mass Effect 1?
I can't remember. Either. I think it's
2. Many games do that. Deus Ex Mankind Divided this year did, it wasn't quite Towers of Hanoi, but it was something very similar where you have kind of three things and you can only permute them in certain ways and usually these puzzles are to find a secret. And it doesn't really matter if you get them right or wrong. And there's always a way to do it that isn't involving a puzzle. All the puzzle is trivially easy. And this is the thing where like, the puzzle is not trivially easy. It's quite difficult. It's going to require a certain amount of actual investment. And I tried it. I felt like the game was telling me you can't solve this. I felt like the game was telling me you're missing some information.
The entire level is telling you, right? Like, these are the ways you go to find the solution.
Yeah, it was like, kill this person and bring them to this person, or kill this other person and bring them to this person, or find another way. And I actually investigated the other way, and the other way was like, oh, you can maybe learn it from this other prisoner or something. It wasn't like, solve the riddle, right? And so I felt like the game was really strongly telling me you can't solve the riddle, but I was still like, oh, I think I can solve the riddle. And I tried solving the riddle, and when I cut out little bits of paper, and I came up with a solution that I was very ready to accept that this was the wrong solution, because the first thing that happened was I came to a contradiction. I came to like a thing where like, okay, it has to go there. And then what I was left with is, oh shit, that doesn't make any sense. That can't work. And so I had to backstep like three steps and then like, oh, I think this was all right by this point. And then I think maybe the solution is this and that doesn't lead to a contradiction. So I'm going to try this. And I tried that and it said no. And at that point, I lost faith and I was like, you know, the game has been telling me so strongly this doesn't work, like you can't solve this. And I tried to solve it and I failed. And I can well believe my solution is wrong, but because the game is also telling me I can't solve this, I'm not going to spend all night trying to resolve this. And so I just went and did the missions and I found the eventual solution. And then I was still like, The other thing that baffled me is when I found the eventual solution that the game actually gives you, you know, you sort of like, you can either kill one faction's leader and bring him to the other faction's leader, or you can kill the other faction's leader and bring him to the other faction's leader, or you can kill neither of them and still get to the person who knew the solution. But when you find the solution, when you come to it naturally by solving the riddle, you end up with a kind of left to right arrangement.
Mm.
And I had entered it that way and it hadn't worked. And then when I found the solution by the game giving it to me, it was in totally the wrong order. And the order was such that it directly contradicted the first clue the riddle gives you. It was like, this person is on the far left, and the solution it gave me, that person was not the first.
Apparently the order doesn't matter when you're entering the door.
It turns out it doesn't matter at all, which is strange, because A, the riddle, if you solve it, gives you a very clear order in which to enter them, and B, if there is no order, if the order doesn't matter, there's no reason for Jindos to have made two sets of tumblers. You only need one set of tumblers in that case.
So yeah, and this is, so like, I sat down with a piece of paper and figured it out and got it right first time, like when I entered it. So, and I was really surprised because I thought, like, I was really surprised to just then get the end of level stat screen and I had barely been in the level. I was just like, whoa, I'm done.
Yeah, it just like, skips a whole chunk of it.
And it felt like, I felt like sort of, again, it was that thing of like, like I said earlier, I consoled myself that I would miss things because this is a game I'm going to play a lot. But I was not like psychologically ready to miss an entire level.
Yeah.
Because, but again, it fit my sort of, I had this image of like, Emily is confronted with this problem and just sits on that bench next to it and like, fuck this, I'm going to figure this out, and just figures it out because that's sort of not fully non-lethal, but sort of like low impact, try and solve things with your brain if you can, character that I'd created for her. kind of fit that perfectly, that she's just going to figure this out. Like, she's a smart cookie. And I was genuinely proud of myself for figuring it out as well, because there's an achievement for it.
Yeah.
And also, like, I think I'd seen your tweet about it, and I ended up, and I couldn't not, so I ended up, I didn't want to spoil anything for people, so I just tweeted a picture of the achievement, which is like, it's not a big spoiler if you don't know anything about the game. So it's like, solve the Jinjosh lock without any clues. And I got people reply on Twitter saying, that's possible. and so that, you know, it was like a little glow of like, I'm the best. Which, you know, I think once you figure out how it works as a riddle, it's actually not that complicated. Like, it's not like amazing feat of logic necessarily. You just got to kind of see what it is, which is like a matrix of different attributes that will only fit in one order.
The tricky things about it was like, when I first read it, and I thought that I was still sort of seeing it as a thing that couldn't be solved, because it was so set up to be a thing that couldn't be solved. And there are, it's about five women at a table, and they're all sitting in five different positions. And as it turns out, they're all drinking five different drinks, and they all have five different heirlooms. They're all wearing five different colors.
And they're from five different places.
Yes. But the way it's phrased, actually, it's, Like all riddles, there's a bunch of assumptions that, there are some assumptions you can make and some assumptions you can't make. And the phrasing of it really requires you to make some assumption leaps, because it says that this person is dressed all in, it's randomized. So the actual, colors and places and things are all different for each person. But for me, it was something like, this person is all in red. This person is all in green. This person is all in purple. This person has a white jacket, and this person has a blue hat. And I'm like, you could wear a blue hat and a white jacket. And the whole puzzle hinges on, it will specifically reference two people in one sentence that could be the same person, or they could be different people.
So I made a guess based more on like game logic than logic at that point, which is like, this feels like a 5x5 grid. Yeah, and as soon as you start separating garments, then it stops being a 5x5 grid and becomes like exponentially more complicated.
Yeah. My deduction was like, if I can't assume this, I can't solve this puzzle. So yeah. I got to assume this.
And I think I got a little bit lucky, because the riddle itself is randomized, and my core assumption turned out to be right. Like, I put everything that didn't contradict it onto the person on the left and extrapolated like sideways from there. And I found that with a few tweaks that worked. Like, I had like an anchor to kind of build the solution around.
I think I know where I went wrong the first time, because I sort of screwed it up the second time as well. And I figured out it led to a contradiction, and I knew where to backtrack this time. And it was because I'd already had to make a bunch of assumptions, and so I was kind of trying to sort of go with the puzzle and see what things it was saying. And there's a key piece of information is that one person says X, and the person next to them is so surprised they spill their neighbor's rum or their neighbor's beer or their neighbor's whiskey or whatever. And you can read that as A surprises B and B spills C's rum.
Or A surprises B and B spills A's rum.
Exactly, And it's one of those things where, like, technically it could be ABA, but the way it's phrased sounds like it's ABC. And so the first time I did it, I assumed it was ABC, and that's like
figuring out that it was ABA was like the key to my solution.
Exactly, when I did it the second time, ABC led to a contradiction and ABA didn't. And I'm like, okay, it's weird, but it's ABA. And that but like, kudos to this to being probably the best actual logic puzzle in a game like
And it felt
it was fun to solve, so, and
it makes no sense that this guy's front door can be unlocked by a smart enough person. Regardless,
unless you sort of accept that, like, the game does have a kind of a premise of everyone in it is pretty stupid. Like, you listen to guards talking, and there's this one particular bark that they have when they're idle, and they're like,
oh, the reading thing.
There's that. Yeah, there's reading is a big deal, and there's some people who are ashamed of not being able to read, and some people are learning to read. Then there's the guy who says, like, so I've got my two, and I've this guy the one. I've still got my one. But what if he eats the one? If I eat the one? And it's just like, it's arithmetic involving numbers from one to two, and he's really struggling with it. And so it feels like the game's kind of general perception of people is that the
education isn't very high
arithmetic.
Standard.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really like, because that is functionally the non-lethal solution to the Dust District. Because the Dust District is also asking you to decide which of these two factions you want to be in power.
Yeah, and that I felt like it was a bit of a weakness. in the game in general, often like the lethal versus non-lethal is sort of a decision where either there's no good answer or one of them is clearly the good answer. And then do you want the overseers or the howlers to win? It's like they go so far out of the way to show you the overseers and the howlers are both fucking pieces of shit and they're just awful. And it's like, there's no interesting decision to make there, I don't think.
It's a weird example. It's the only example where the sort of the best decision is to do nothing.
Yeah.
Like, and it's
you still have a lot of freedom. So you can skip the whole thing by solving a Jindos lock, or you can kill them both, or you can knock them both out and send them both to the mines.
Mm.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't see this one.
Okay, so both of them, either one of them that you don't like, you can either kill them, or there is a... did you get into Durante's room?
I didn't do that mission.
Okay, so you literally skipped the line.
I haven't gotten that far with Corvo yet.
Normally, your choice is, there's the overseers and the howlers, and they both own chunks of this territory, and it's made very clear to you in very gamey terms that the only way you could ever talk to any of these leaders is if you were literally carrying the body of the other leader. And they can be unconscious or they can be dead. Actually, maybe they have to be dead. But yeah, if you want to go to one of these, if you want to walk into overseer territory, then you need to be carrying Paolo's body. And if you want to walk into Paolo's territory, you want to be carrying the overseer leader's body. And they will let you in if you are. But all of it hinges. So I was coming at it from, I tried Jindosh's lock and my first solution was rejected. And I could well believe my solution was wrong for the riddle. I was like, well prepared for that. But I also was so unsure as to whether the right solution would even work. It was so heavily implied to me that there was no way to solve this that, I was like, okay, well, I tried to solve it logically. It didn't work. So I'll do what you're saying. And then from then on, it was like, well, actually, now that I look at the heart, there's a whole bunch of like runes and bone charms and things that I want to get here. And one of them is in this room in the Howler's territory that is locked. And it's one of those like steel locked doors that you just, you can't open it except for plot reasons. Like you're going to have the actual real key for it. And that is one of the things, well, there were so many things that told me the riddle wasn't the way to go. Like I tried it and it didn't work. And I wasn't sure if I was right or wrong. And then B, it tells you here's solution A to solving this thing to get the solution, and here's solution B to get the solution. And then in addition to those A and B, it also says, or find another way. And it pretty quickly becomes clear that the other way is to break into Durante's room. And he's a howler who has been, since captured by the overseers. And so both of them kind of have a claim to him. Like his room is literally in literally in howler's territory. But he himself is in overseer's territory, but then when you go and find him, he's dead, and he just has a key on him, which unlocks his room in Howler's territory. But he is the guy who knows how to open the Jindosh lock, and he has the solution. He's like, the actual solution is written in his room. If you kill one of the leaders and bring them to the other one, I don't think this counts if you only knock them out, but if you actually kill them and you bring them to the other one, they will just tell you, because the overseer people captured Durante, so they have all his possessions, and I think the Howlers, I've never tried it this way, but I suspect if you kill the Overseer leader and bring them to the Howlers, that the Howler leader just knows Durante's secrets and tells you. But even if you do both those things, there is a bone charm in Durante's room, so you need the key to Durante's room, so you basically need to do both. You need to clean out both those places. And when you do, the solution is written there, but like I said, it's written in the wrong order to the point where it feels like the person who wrote that solution does not understand the riddle. Like, okay, maybe this is the right pairing of the names to the heirlooms, but you did not know who sat on the left. And if you solve the puzzle, you know who's it. Like, one of the cool things about that puzzle is when you solve it, you know everything. You know
that'd where be an interesting
everybody
way sat,
you know what everybody drank, you know what everybody's wearing. Yeah.
The game to tell you, like, or for the game to be able to tell whether you really solved it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. I can't remember why I was doing that.
The sending to the mines thing.
Oh yeah. So yeah, it's really subtle. But Durante himself is a member of the Howlers, but he sort of, his loyalty sways And he and someone else, I don't know, remember who, sort of scheme. Fill me in about this, because I think this was a solution in Dishonored 1 as well.
For the Pendleton twins.
Right. So
Slackjaw will send them to the mines.
You can, you know, Aramis Stilton is a miner and runs the mines. And this guy, Durante, is running a scheme where he has sort of promised two miners to Stilton or to whoever runs the mines. And his plan is that instead of sending his buddies, he's going to send Paolo and the High Overseer.
Liam.
He's going to basically destroy the two main factions and send them both to the mines, which is wildly ambitious. I don't know how he plans to do this, because I'm the fucking Empress of the world.
You're a teleporting magic
incredible magician. And I could only just do this, but I did do it for him. I read his thing and I'm like, yeah, that seems like a good idea. I've listened to these two factions. I do not think either of them should run this place. I think they're both terrible. And so I agree with you. They should both be got rid of. And yeah, there's a Silvergraph studio, with two of those incredibly suspiciously human sized crates. And, it was a really interesting moment. Nothing really came of it, but if you read up on this, it becomes clear, oh, no, not only do you not have to take sides on this, but you can also resolve it non-lethally. And I don't really know if this is the best solution, but it's certainly the sort of default goody-two-shoes solution is you don't kill anyone, you don't take sides, you just put them in these crates and they end up in the mines and, you know, so be it, because they're both bad guys. I did that, but also I was just in default stealth game mode. So when I went into the Silvergraph studio, which I knew I was there, I knew I was going to dump these bodies in there. But there's a bunch of silver bars just lying on the side, and I picked one of, there's two of them, and I picked one of them up, and then I read the note, and the note is so as discussed, here's the two bodies and here's the full payment. I'm like, oh shit, there's only half payment there. And there's no way to put down gold. Dishonored does not include the verb to give money to anyone ever.
Put back.
So if you've taken half the money, I'm like, is this going to work anymore? I can give you the two bodies and I'll do whatever you want, but I took half the money and I have no way of giving you more money. So I don't know if this will happen. As it turns out, the game just takes it as you did it the non-lethal way. Those people are in the mines now. But at the time, I was like, shit, this game, so often this game has convinced me that it really simulates things and it really is paying attention to what I do. And I just picked up a gold bar that I did not mean to pick up, really. And I would like both the gold bars to be
there. You need to get the follow-up letter, which is we didn't have full payments, so we delivered them to the sea. Good luck on your non-lethal playthrough, asshole. Cheap asshole.
Actually, on that playthrough, I would have been okay with it, because it was my main concern was you know, you're asking me which of these two factions do I want to win, and it was so clear that neither of them should win. It was they're both terrible.
Yeah. That, again, I filed under, I'm going to sort this out when I'm Empress again.
Yeah.
This is a shit situation, but I can't do anything about it now.
You've probably encountered this already, but one of the things I just discovered as playing as Corvo is I played as Emily twice, and I think the very first letter that is on the Dreadful Whale is a letter from you to Wyman, sort of saying, telling him or her what's going on. And then the next letter you see there is from Wyman. If you're playing as Corvo, who doesn't have a boyfriend or girlfriend as far as we know,
your
first letter is to the parents of Alexei, telling them, sorry, your daughter's dead. I'm going to set this right as soon as Emily is restored to the throne. And actually, Alexei herself, when I played the intro, I saw she's in the intro, and then later on she dies. I'm so bad at connecting things that I didn't even recognize that the person you get the sword from is the same person who sort of introduces you to, who opens the door in the first place in the intro. But way later on, five missions later on, I'd seen this book lying around all over the place, Emily Coldwyn, the Child Empress. And I at last read it, and I wasn't expecting it to be that interesting. I don't read a lot of just background lore, but this one is about how the reason I haven't read it is because it's called The Child Empress, and I didn't really want to read about how I'm just some generic kid and no one cares about what I think or do. But actually that particular book is about how you stopped being called the Child Empress.
Mm.
And it's about how no one called Emily Caldwell the Child Empress after this one day when she was in this carriage and she got attacked by, I can't remember who, but enemies of her rule. And she doesn't even really save the day, but Alexei does. And she throws a grenade or something and kills like three of them. And then Emily beats up the last two and she still doesn't kill them. She's kind of arrests them and brings them to trial. And after that day, everyone was like, okay, she's not a kid anymore. She's a real adult. And that was really effective in terms of like, now I know who Alexei is. Like she's my best friend and she saved my life. And after that, I made her captain of the guard, which is totally understandable because she's badass and she's, you know, not just good at her job, but also someone I deeply personally trust, and she saved my life and everything. And in retrospect, suddenly I'm way more cut up about her being killed. Like it suddenly makes way more sense.
I was going to say, actually, like, I really liked the Wyman detail, Emily's partner. So ambiguous. I read it as a boyfriend, but I think that's because I did some research into the book, and I think Wyman is confirmed as a nobleman in the book, but I'm saying that in a podcast voice because I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I remember you saying that, and I'm sure that's true. Apparently, I didn't see this myself, but I heard the second hand that someone was saying that they have, like, Arcane, maybe Harvey, has said that it is intentional that in the game that the gender is never mentioned of Wyman.
Okay. Like, yeah, no, I can buy that as well. I mean, I liked it as a detail. I think it helps a lot.
I really like it even if it is just a guy.
Yeah.
Even if it's just, I'm a girl and he's a guy and it's just a conventional heterosexual relationship. It's still really cool to have.
Yeah, sorry. Just saying.
That's way better than trying to leave it open-ended. Like if you say, oh, we don't want to impose anything on the player and he or she should be free to imagine whatever he or she wants to imagine. I still think, like, particularly as a female protagonist, it's really rare to just have a boyfriend.
Yeah, I actually, for that reason, like, I think, obviously it's tricky territory for games to navigate, but female protagonists are very rarely given, like, romantic relationships anyway, because, you know, some aspect of the male gaze in the way female characters are designed for games sort of always has the protagonist be single, essentially, and, you know, married to the player or, you know, something like that. But also particularly they seem to shy away from having women who the player controls show like romantic interest in men, really.
Yeah.
Like often I think to avoid, you know, some sense that they might alienate a straight male player.
Yeah.
So I liked the idea that, you know, she has an off camera partner. Like, I like that idea either way, but whether, you know, whether Wyman is male or female, but I think, you know, it felt particularly sort of, I guess unusual relative to other games of this type. Like, to have that be the case. So that brings us to, we should get on to Cracking the Slab. Cause I appreciate that we've been talking about Dishonored for 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Jesus, <right? laughs>
You can complete Dishonored faster than it has taken us to complete Dishonored. So after the Dust District, you go to Artemis Dilton's Manor. And this was a detail, like the mechanic of this level is something that I think had been spoiled for me.
Yeah.
Some marketing material. It might have even been, actually no, it was on the preview trip. That's why I fucking knew what was going to happen.
It was, strangely, it was spoiled for me, and yet I somehow conflated it with the Clockwork Mansion. And so, cause I knew I'd done the Clockwork Mansion, I was not
expecting another high concept manor.
Yeah. Once I played it, I was like, oh yeah, I do remember someone saying you could transport in time.
Actually, I would say like the Clockwork Manor, this felt like another level I want to go back to and try again. Cause my first time through it felt like fudging. Cause so the, you know, the high concept of Stilton's Manor is time travel. Mm-hmm. That you have access to two timelines.
What's the time difference?
3 years.
3 years, okay.
Cause it's the night that they summoned Delilah back from the void.
Yeah.
Because I actually thought at first there were some problems with this, because one of the things the guards will say when they're in full alert mode is, well, I hope it's not that damn crown killer. And I thought, is that anachronistic? Like I initially thought, is that a bug? Cause it is one of the guards' standard lines the rest of the game, but it isn't, because Alexandria in Grim Alex mode, in Crown Killer mode, is at the ritual.
Yes.
So the Crown Killer clearly existed at that time. So so that actually does work.
It's been long going.
Yeah, 3 years. And like, there's some nice Emily lines, like, I wonder what I was doing now.
Yeah.
Cause you know, she would have only been 3 years younger. So it's not like she was a kid or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, you go 3 years back in the past and you can switch between the two timelines, which.
And so, we don't want to spoil what it is, but there is another game in which you can do this.
Yeah.
And recently, it came out before Dishonored 2. And it's a bit of a shame, really, because I think if I'd never encountered this before, I would have been a whole order of magnitude more impressed.
I think I had a similar experience. And, it's interesting that it's the same idea, which is to have two timelines, because there are games that have like Singularity was a pretty good 7 out of 10 shooter from a few years ago that allowed you to switch environments between the past and present versions of themselves. But that was like, each was like a fixed state of the world.
Yeah.
Whereas in this iteration, in the 2016 iteration of this idea in games, the two timelines are both happening at the same time.
Yeah.
So.
And that, I think that's different to the other game that does this recently.
No, it's not. Oh, it's the same.
Okay.
But so, we can't spoil another game inside the Dishonored spoiler cast. So,
but in Dishonored 2, you can look into the other timeline simultaneously and sort of see events unfolding in both timelines at once, which kind of really rams home the fact that they're both running at the same time. And so, like, you know, T plus 5 minutes in one is T plus 5 minutes in the other.
Yeah.
Regardless of
that is true in both of the games.
Okay. About.
But yeah. So it allows you to like, because it does the cardinal sin of taking away your powers and stuff and replacing it with time travel.
That actually does bother me. I think it was fine for one playthrough, but I'm on my third playthrough now, but my second playthrough, I was really like, I'm going to do this one again. And like, I found some interesting ways to do it, but it's really like having one power. It's not like you have no powers, you have one power. And it's a new one, it's an interesting one, and if you've never used it before, it's super interesting. But if you have used it before, particularly if you've used it before in this other game, it's a bit less interesting. And I'm, like, the reason so the other game that has a level like this is a straightforward shooter in any other respect. And so when it does this interesting thing, it's so cool, and it's like, oh my god, this is so different to everything else, and it's so interesting and so fun to play around with. And Dishonored, in its default state, is so rich and has so many abilities and so many options that when you take those away and you replace them with one novel idea, if I'd never seen it in my life before, yeah, I'd probably be all right with it one time through. I was all right with it one time through. But then the second time through, I was thinking, I sort of did this once already.
Yeah.
I don't have another way of doing this. If you take away all my other powers, I can only do the one way.
So like I found myself sort of fudging through it the first time, and maybe another time I might try and solve a few more of the puzzles that get you runes and stuff, like the time puzzles. Some of them are cool, like incinerating a dog's carcass so it can't spawn blood ties in the future.
I actually, the first time through I did it, I found found the flooded basement rune, which is, there's a special achievement for that because they sort of recognize it's a pain in the ass to do, and you do it. There are lots of puzzles, that involve specifically changing something in the past in order to affect something in the future, which is cool. And then on the second time through, I was like, I knew I wasn't going to like doing this a second time. And so I'm just going to breeze through it. I did breeze through it, and you can breeze through it, and it's very fast. And then I got out of it. And, what actually happened was, I tweeted about this, but I got all the way back to the boat. And then my only options were like, no, I still want to stay here, or say nothing. Where is my option to just say I want to go? And then I was, oh, I didn't actually observe the seance in the past that tells me how Delilah is immortal. All I did was I dealt with Aramis Stilton, who is not even part of the objective. He's just a guy who's just there. And you know that in the current present day, he is mad. And if you go into the past, you can change that by either knocking him out or killing him. Or you can do nothing at all, which is what I did. I decided that I wanted to knock him out because I'd done that the first time through. and he knew it was a good thing to do. So I did it the second time through, and I knocked him out, and I took him out of his courtyard, and I left, and I just went all the way back to the start. And then I found out.
You might forget to do something.
That was not the objective of the goal. That was not what I was trying to do. No one really cares what happened to Aaron Stilton. I was supposed to observe what happened to Delilah, and I didn't do that. And,
yeah, you're not allowed to take information you already know from a previous playthrough forward.
There's many interesting things about, that happen if you do that. One is, even on multiple playthroughs, it's an awesome mission in that, whatever you do in the past dramatically affects the present. And I was, even on my first playthrough, I was a little bit cynical about it because I'd already seen this mechanic done in another game, and I'd seen some puzzles that depended on me doing stuff in the past, and my favorite one was like, you go to the future and there's a safe that's locked, and you don't know what the combination is. You go to the past and there's a safe that's got the combination locked, you know what the combination is. You go to the future, the safe is broken, everything is stolen already, but the door is on the floor,
and
when
you
look at the door on the floor, it's on the combination that it would have been in when it was finally unlocked. So whoever did steal it did know the combination, and so you know the combination from what they entered before they destroyed the safe. And so you go back in time, and then you enter that combination, and you get to steal the stuff. And there's a whole load of puzzles that are just like that, that are just kind of about like traveling in time. There's more of them than I realized, actually. And so on my second playthrough, I was... even on my first playthrough, I was like, oh god, this is going to be a pain in the ass to play through again, because I don't have any of my abilities. I want to use Domino, I want to use Blink, I want to use Far Reach. I want to use all this stuff, and I can't. And I still stand by that. The basic business of dealing with guards is much less fun on this mission than it is on other missions, because on other missions I have so many options, and I can do it so many different ways. But on my second playthrough, I was like, oh, fuck this, okay, yeah, I'm just going to rush through it then. And I did rush through it, and I did it, and I succeeded. And I actually, I had done all the objectives, and I got to the end of it, and I was just like, oh, I feel so... Just before I'd done this mission, I had sort of reached that point where I'd got all of the main powers I wanted, and all the spare runes I had stocked up. I decided I'm going to spend them on bone charm crafting, because some of the bone charms I've got are kind of okay, and I want them to be four times as effective, which is what you can do with bone charm crafting. And in particular, I never had this one before, but I finally found the one that increases sneaking speed.
Right, yeah.
And if you do that four times, sneaking speed is super fast, and it's actually like, it's faster than running, and it's really, really good. It's the only bone charm that's actually been like generally super effective. So I did that. I was really invested in my playthrough, and then that was when Aramis Stilton's mission happened, and that was the one I didn't really look forward to doing again. And I rushed through it, and after I rushed through it, I knew I hadn't done that mission well, and I was starting to, set on the Duke's villa. And I found, not only did I not enjoy doing that mission again, but I just didn't care about a playthrough anymore. I just didn't care who this person was. I had lost all investment that I had in my whole playthrough. And, I suddenly realized, like, skipping this mission, sort of blowing through it and doing it in this way that didn't make sense for my character, had ruined the whole game. I was just not going to be able to play from now on. And so instead, I went back and I loaded my save game from before the whole mission, and I decided, I'm going to go through this, and even though I've done it before, I'm going to find every single bone charm and every single rune, and I'm going to go through every single thing. And in doing so, I discovered, like, at least two time travel puzzles I didn't know about before. Like the reinforced windows one.
I don't think I did that one.
Okay, so there's one where there are loads of time travel puzzles that are very subtle, and they're so subtle that you almost, even when you solve them, you're almost unclear on what you did exactly. But, they're all about, if you change something in the past, you change something in the future. And there's this one thing where there's a bunch of workers who are not guards. They are just working.
Oh, I know those guys, yeah.
Reinforcing the windows. And I'd seen them before, and I'd dealt with them before, but last time I just knocked them out without really considering what they're doing. But they're kind of talking about reinforcing the windows. And my brain is thinking, like, if I take these guys out in the past, all of the windows in the future should be not reinforced. But I'm switching between timelines, and I'm seeing almost all the windows in the future are reinforced already without these guys. Like, I don't think I can change this. And you can kill those guys, and it doesn't change that. But there's this one window, and you can read a note. It's hilariously contrived, but it kind of works. You read a note that says, look, I don't care that it's the Duke. I don't care that it's Aramis Dilton. I don't care that he's the, you know, in this position of power or whatever. Even if it was the Duke himself, these builders cannot fix this except tonight. Like, this is the only night they can do. If you can have them tonight, then it's fine. If you can't have them tonight, they can't do it for like months. They're just booked up. And it doesn't totally explain why, if you interrupt them tonight, they will not be able to do it for another 3 years. Like, it doesn't say that, but it just hints to you that, like, it's more than just tonight. If you knock these guys out, they're in the middle of a job. If you knock them out, that job doesn't get done. It doesn't really fully explain why it doesn't get done for 3 years, but it says there's a reason it doesn't get done tomorrow night. There's a reason it doesn't get done this week. And because it's reinforcing windows, I know there's something mechanically significant about this. Like, if I take these guys out, I don't know what window is not going to be reinforced, but some window is not going to be reinforced if I take these guys out. And it's not about killing them. It's, you know, just they can't do their job tonight. And that like letter was enough to tip me off to that. And yeah, there's some bone charm or rune that is up in the attic. And the only way you can get to it is if they don't reinforce that window in the past, so that in the future the window is open, and then you walk through the window, and then the past, there's a chandelier you can stand on, and then, I can't remember which timeline it's in, but in one of the timelines there's a rafter from the attic that's bent down, and you can climb up.
Yeah, I did that
it.
The other way, I think, through the by raising the chandelier so I could get onto the one that
Okay, great. And then once you get up in there, like, that's where the bone charm is, or the whatever it is. You get it. And then just, like, I'm up in the attic, and I know I had to go into the past to get up here. And then I'm just curious about, what if I go into the future while I'm up here? And you go up in the future, and there's no way out of it. You're stuck in the attic if you're, if you were stuck in the future. And there's just, like, every shelf of every bookcase in there has a different thing. Like, there's all the tranquilizer darts you could want. There's all the spring razors you could want. There's all the grenades you could
they
want.
They really stocked it up with razors.
Yeah, it's like, we can't give you a bone charm or a rune because that would be detectable by heart. But if you came here for the bone charm or the rune in the past and then you thought to switch to the future, you get all this other loot. And it's really nice done.
Something that I wish should work, and I would normally pick holes in the logic of the game. I tried this, but you just get barked at by a dog. go back outside to where the entrance to the house is in the future.
Mm.
Go to the past and then just try and walk in, because at that point you are the completely undisposed empress. Like, you were just the empress, right? Like,
they get just pissed off at you, right?
Yeah, they it's like there's an intruder, right? So yeah. But what it should be is, like, take the fucking mask off. Be like, hey, I'm Empress Emily Cauldron. I am the Empress. I know you weren't expecting me, but I really need to come in.
Yeah.
Like, look, my face is on all the money.
So what did you do to Aramis Dilton?
Nothing.
You did nothing?
Yeah. Ah. Because I actually didn't think to do anything to him, because I didn't want to fuck up the timelines.
Yeah.
So
that's a wise precaution. I didn't take that precaution.
So I, you know, he's out of the little gazebo.
Yep.
With the book that has the code for the door.
Yep.
I sort of went, basically, like, figured out where he was using, like, looking through the glass, looking through the lens to kind of see the past. And then, like, wait till he turned around, then, like, materialized in the past, read the book, and then immediately switched back to the present behind him, and then snuck back into the house and did it that way. So, yeah, I didn't knock him out or kill him or anything.
Right. So it's, I've never tried that. I've knocked him out, and I think I've killed him. I don't think I've ever not done either. The first time I did it, I wasn't really planning to knock him out. I didn't have an idea of what I was going to do. And I got there and I read the code and I was like, okay, I got the code. And then I was like, oh shit, there's Aramis Dilton. I'm like, well, I'm not going to kill him. I don't have any beef with him. I guess I'll knock him out. And I knocked him out. And then immediately Emily says, by knocking out Aramis Dilton, I've changed the past. But how? And I'm like, I don't know. Let's find out. So I carried him with me and I left the whole place. And it was, I've been a little bit harsh on that mission because it's very much a novelty mission, and the novelty had been worn off by this other game that also did that mission. And so I was a little bit harsh on it, and even though what it was doing was cool, I was a little bit like, I kind of seen this idea before, and I'm annoyed that you took my abilities away. And then I knocked out Aramis Dilton, and I didn't know why I was doing it. I was like, I didn't know why I was doing this. But then Emily said something about like, she said she changed the past. And then at some point she's kind of said like, she sort of saved him from seeing whatever sent him mad.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's a good idea. I didn't think of that, but
good
apparently,
idea, me.
Apparently I did that. And then you go back to the past, you go back to the present and his mansion is just like, in every bit as much splendor as it was in the past.
Oh, wow.
It's in the daytime. And it's full of staff and maids and stuff. And the first thing you hear is, it's very contrived, but it kind of works, is one housekeeper talking to another saying, do you know when Aramis will be back? Because I want to beat out these rugs, but I know because of his asthma, it'll, you know, make him choke and stuff because he, you know, spent all these years in the mines. And so it basically tells you, like, Aramis is not here. But here we all are. He owns this house. We still live here.
Mm.
And then, sorry, I'm very interested to hear about this. Cause there's a huge, huge effect of this that I didn't notice at all. I didn't notice until I did it a second playthrough. I did it a different way. And then after my second playthrough, I heard about someone telling me how it works out differently. I think it's just Phil saying like, you know, how you deal with this guy dramatically determines the future. And I think I was reading like a bug report or something and it said, oh, if you don't do this, then Megan's arm and eye won't be restored. And I'm like,
what?
Yeah, if you knock Aramis Stilton unconscious, then when you come back to the present, Megan's injuries are gone. Because her injuries were incurred at some point during her, her liaison with Aramis Stilton.
Yeah, her, there's a letter from her in the house.
So I never learned that.
Oh shit.
But I did knock out Aramis Stilton and I didn't notice that she had her arm back and her eye back for the rest of the game. That's and then only when someone amazing. Else pointed out to me, I'm like, oh my God.
Cause like, it didn't even occur to me. My whole mission in the past was like, I'm going to touch as little as possible. I couldn't even knock out any guards. It was just like, unless I really had to, because it was like, don't fucking touch anything.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So yeah, so, man, that's awesome.
And so, yeah, once I found out that happened, like, it had happened for sure. I just missed it on my first playthrough. My second playthrough, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I read about that. And so I actually, it was just as about to do the crack in the slab mission, and I wasn't really sure how I was going to do it, how I was going to do it differently. And then I read about this thing that like, oh, if you knock out Aramis Stilton, I was, even before I knew about this, I was very, quite cynical about this mission. And then when I knocked out Aramis Stilton and I came back to the present and his mansion was pristine, I was really moved by it in an unexpected way. I thought I was totally disengaged with things. I knew how the mechanics worked, but just like, this is a game that's been so depressing and so negative throughout. Like everyone, even, you know,
nothing good happens to anyone, yeah, really.
The guards who are innocent are just jerks and idiots. And then the witches who are sort of associated with the bad faction, as you say, are kind of like a semi-decent sort of bunch
sympathetic
of
at least
in some
yeah.
ways. But they're still your enemies. And everyone's kind of, no matter what they have going for them, they're always kind of bad in some way. And this is the first time where I was like, oh shit, like, Aramis Stilton was basically a good guy, and if you save him from this one thing, I don't know why it sends him mad, but if you stop it from sending him mad, he's one of the only good people in this world, and his staff kind of say that, they kind of like, yeah, yeah, he's, you know, he has this really bad cough, but he's doing
it's not the
his
worst
best.
Character deficiency yeah, like,
compared to the worst thing about anyone else in this world. He's doing pretty
you
well.
Imagine pointing the heart at him and he's like, he's got a really bad cough.
And it wasn't
but
so
it's
much
not
about,
that bad.
I didn't really have any hard evidence about what he was like as a person, but it was just this place was pretty and nice. And it wasn't nice because some asshole had screwed over some other people. It was like, he'd worked his way up and sort of earned it and his staff respected him. And yeah, I found myself kind of quite touched by it. I was like, oh my God, I didn't really mean to. I just throttled this guy.
Choking people is my default state now.
But then the voiceover told me I'd done the right thing. And I was like, oh yeah, maybe I had done the right thing. And I went back to the present and I was like, oh my God, I've had this huge effect on the world. And this was even without me noticing that I'd saved Megan her injuries.
That's
then,
awesome.
So, yeah, on my second playthrough, I can't remember what I did with Armour Stilton, but I was like, oh shit, this was actually had an effect. So I went back and loaded my old save game to check. Did she really have an extra arm and eye that I didn't even notice?
Extra arm.
Oh my god. Like,
if you choke him out twice, she has arms.
Exactly. Like, if I had had a companion who had two arms and then she gained an extra arm, I feel like for sure I would have noticed that. So like for a moment I felt bad and then I thought, maybe this is incredibly virtuous of me not to notice that this person with a disability no longer had the disability. Maybe I'm just incredibly open-minded that I didn't even notice.
Or you were too busy running and jumping around the boat for no reason.
That's also possible. And so, yeah, I reloaded it and I went to like the last, I'd say pretty much a new save game after every mission, which is, by the way,
worth doing.
Yeah. Probably everyone's listened to this too late, but if you're not already to like make a new save after every mission, because it's really useful. And so I loaded it again. And the weirdest thing about it is you can't say anything to her. Right, like a short way before you talk to her, Emily says something about like, I've changed the past and who knows what. She's just like, a bunch of things will have changed in the present. And then she also says some separate thing about like, other people won't even notice that I've changed those things. And I'm like, okay, yeah, that's true. But if I had known someone who only has one arm and I just changed something in the past that made her two arms, I would say something to her. Like, she wouldn't notice, obviously, because for her it's been the same all the time. But I would say, like, oh my god, you have two arms.
And then who looks like a weirdo?
Yeah, I would look like a weirdo to her, but it would still be like, I feel like I would mention it.
I mean, it's established in dialogue that, like, Emily or Corvo doesn't tell Sokolov or Megan what happened in the manor.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of, like, Sokolov has a line. She's like, I don't know why you're not telling us, but however you found this out.
When I came back from Clockwork Mansion and Megan says something like, I bet you have a story to tell. And I'm like, yeah, let me tell you about the story about how I screwed over this guy.
Yeah.
I think there is someone, shit, I can't remember her name. But if you knock out Aramis Stilton, when you come back to the Dust District, it's way better. And the Duke is still talking over the Tannoy, but he's talking about something that the Aramis Stilton made him do, and it's better. And there is someone whose name I don't recall, who's kind of working in an office, and she's kind of taken charge of the Dust District, and she's trying to make things better. Does this sound anything?
Well, as I say, I didn't do anything in the past, so I didn't see it. Could it be, Mindy?
Luca is the
Duke.
Yeah. Shit, I can't
remember
either
floor.
Of her names. She has two names. But you can talk to her and there's a whole, like, dialogue between you and her about, the future of the Dust District.
Oh, cool.
It might be something to do with actually the fact that I didn't side with either faction.
Mm.
Like, if you take out both the factions and then you also knock out Aramis Stilton, then she's the one who takes over, maybe. She seems like a good person, but it also seemed like I should have already known who she was, and I didn't.
As I say, like, do not know. But it's amazing the depth that mission goes to, because as you say, it's a bit of a risky prospect for them, because it is more of a binary proposition and more of a puzzle.
Yeah.
But it kind of becomes Dishonored-y because of the amount that it respects the decisions that you make. Right? Like, even though the core mechanic is not something you'd want to see repeated maybe from one level. So the mission after that is the mission to take down
the Duke. I love that he has a double.
That's like, such a good idea.
So Brianna and him, the two kind of, I feel like, classic examples of a great way to do an assassination target in an assassination game.
Mm.
Brianna has two bone charms that protect her from assassination in different ways, and researching them beforehand gets you that information, and you know to approach her a different way. Like, shooting with a crossbow bolt is not going to work because it's going to turn into blood flies. And the Duke, I wasn't told this, that I had to go and find it out, that he has a double, and that would have been so amazing to kind of like find a perfect way to assassinate the Duke and then kill him and be like, I don't know how they communicated to the player exactly, but just to be told like, that wasn't the Duke. He, like, one of his ways he protects himself against assassination is he has a identical twin.
Yeah, yeah.
Or whatever it is.
So, I wasn't sure what I was going to do going into this level, and it's a beautiful environment. It's one thing I have to say.
I love
it. It's, it's an extraordinarily modern looking building.
They show you in the, like, the sort of illustrated, story bits where it's just a voiceover and some illustrations. They show this beautiful, like, it almost looks like a Sydney Opera House. Mm. It's a very stylish mansion. And, they show you that and I was like, oh my God, that looks so cool to infiltrate. And then you start the mission and it's the streets again. And I don't know when it was exactly, but at some point I thought I was seeing the Duke's Mansion and it was way more boxy and boring than I thought it was going to be. And I was like, oh man, I'm so disappointed that it's not like that screenshot. And then it turns out that was just like the station. And then you go to the actual Duke's Mansion and it's exactly, exactly like what the illustration looked like, but then I climbed on the roof and it's these huge wooden, they're almost like propeller blades, these huge like aerodynamic, beautifully curved things. And not only are they like beautifully curved, but when you get up close to them, like the sort of lacquer and varnish on them reflects the light in the exact right way, and it's just like everything about it is so perfect.
It's because it's almost like a modernist building. Like you're even though the game is set in sort of the Dishonored equivalent of like the 1850s or something like that, you know, obviously the technology is very different and the society is very different in some ways, and it feels like you sort of fast forwarded to like almost past Art Deco, right? Like whatever that universe's version of that would be. It reminded me of it reminded me of the Maltese Falcon for some reason. It has like, it has that kind of like, it's almost like film noir crime boss mansion kind of feel to it. Like the sort of, some sort of like a Humphrey Bogart character should be like ending an adventure there as well. Like it, yeah. You know, there's a noir element to Dishonored in some ways, and that maybe is one of the ways it fits. I had a strange experience with that mission again, because it felt like, I remember the first time I did the return to the tower in Dishonored 1 where you take down the Lord Regent, and it was over very quickly because I was good at infiltrating by then and I had very good magical powers. And through a sort of trying to take an aerial route and careful listening to guards and stuff, I actually found the real Duke straight away in his study. And the heart seemed to confirm that, yep, that's the real one. And
he was in his study?
Yeah, above his bedroom.
Huh.
Was he not for you?
No.
Okay.
So I found the fake Duke in, I feel like, his bedroom or something. Like, in a place where, yeah, it was a bedroom on an upper floor, and it was also overlooking a lower floor with, I don't know, some kind of desk, but it wasn't his office officially. And this guy was smoking. And so
that's the tell, right?
Yeah, right away I'm like, okay, this is the fake Duke. And I talked to him about a bunch of stuff, and then I went off to find the real Duke. And I don't know if I found this before I found him, but there was some intel suggesting that he is out in the garden, sort of in the far extreme of the place. And I don't think I found that intel at the time that I found him, but I was on the roof and, yeah, I did have some kind of intel that he was out. I can't remember what I was acting on exactly, but he was out in the garden. And basically there's an arc pylon right in the far fringes of the grounds. And he was standing right near it with a hound right near him and two guards.
Huh.
And I can't remember...
I wonder if this is randomized.
I was coming at this from the roof and... For whatever reason, it was really easy for me to disable the arc pylon, and it was really easy for me to slip by the guards, and all I had to do was basically kill the dog, and then, or take out the dog, and, then take out the Duke, and he was standing right on a balcony. I think right as I approached him, he told the guards, like, leave me, I want some privacy. And they walked away from the arc pylon. I'd already disabled the arc pylon, and I had some weird moment where I had, I think I tranquilized the dog, and then I darted down and I choked out the Duke. And then the best way to get him out of there was to drop down over this cliff. And, I picked up the Duke and I far reached down and I dropped him down on the grass. And then I far reached back up to pick up the dog. So I didn't want the guards to find the dog. And I picked up the tranquilized dog. And I sort of accidentally like threw him over the cliff and he like bounced off the rock and into the sea. I'm like, okay, that dog's probably not alive anymore.
That dog.
Sorry. And, then had to like go back down and pick up the Duke again and then run off with him.
So yeah, mine was completely different to that. So the Duke was in his study and he'd go and read books on the bookshelf and walk around, but he was completely alone otherwise. And I had him first and I realized it was the real one. He wasn't smoking, but he wasn't like not smoking, if you know what I mean. Like, I was like, he could smoke any minute. So I watched him for a while and he's the heart. I was pretty sure it's the real one, but I went to explore and found the duplicate, in a couple of floors below in like a kind of bedroom study area. And so I took out the guards in there and spoke to the guy and sort of made that plan to swap them. And then went back up to the study. And when you talk to the, you know, and then I can't remember the opening line is when you talk to the duplicate. But it's something like, very well, you found me. What do you want? And then I went and talked to the real Duke, you know, after having made this plan with the duplicate. And he says, well, you found me. And it's exactly the same voice. You found me. What do you want? And, I told him like, you know, I'm Emily Caldwin. You're going to pay for what you've done.
Wow.
At which point he turns and runs like down the stairs. But I had already hacked the alarm panel. So he runs straight for the alarm and goes to fire it and it just like fizzes out and doesn't do anything. And he's like, oh shit. And I've already turned to like the smoke form and I'm like, go towards him and I just grab him and like do the non-lethal smoke takedown. But it felt like a really like cinematic, like, and now the wrath of God is upon you. And then I dump him on his bed. And have you seen the cutscene, the non-lethal takedown for the Duke cutscene?
Yes.
Yeah. Where he gets taken away and replaced with the duplicate. Yep. But it felt really like, it felt even better because of the way I was sort of role playing it, that I had shown myself to him.
Yeah.
Because his sort of raving of like, yeah, you know, more like absurd. I was visited by the Empress and turned into a smoke monster. Like,
you gotta believe me.
it felt like a really perfect ending to that. Cause also it's a really clever solution. Like it's,
when I found the fake Duke, I had, for whatever reason, the guard who's near him, if you just wait, he does walk away and like, the fake Duke says, oh, leave me. I want to be alone with my thoughts or whatever. But I had taken him out because I'd had some playthrough where I tried it and he had spotted me even though I talked to the Duke. So I knocked this guard out and I was just looking for a place to hide him. So I just walked into the nearest room and threw him onto the bed and that was fine. And then went through the whole rest of the mission and, took out the real Duke and knocked him out. And, does he have like a pendant or something on him that you, you gotta bring something on him to the fake Duke in order to make that work. And I did that. And then, you know, the real Duke I'd brought to the fake Duke, which you have to do. And, the fake Duke goes off and like calls the alarm and has the guards drag the real Duke away. They drag him away to the bedroom, it seems, where they found the unconscious guard. And so as soon as they drag him, they're like, oh my God, who is this? So they had to have an alarm because of that.
Yeah, because this whole thing took place in the bedroom for me. So there was no, like that was where I ended up taking the guy down, that place where they drag him to. So yeah. Yeah, I'd like to go back to that mission because the bit after that, like trying to break into the vault was pretty straightforward after having already taken out the Duke. I loved like having the corrupted heart. Like it doesn't have as much to say when it's Delilah in the heart rather than Jessamine, but it's a really nice touch that you have.
Because I was very focused on what like the perception of my enemies was to what I'm doing. And so as soon as I got Delilah as the heart, I would like, every time I did something bad for her, like killed one of her friends, I would point to the heart of her and like point, like, what do you think of this, huh? She never really had anything to say about it. I was like, that's what I want to do. It's like, look at what I did. Look at what I did.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting to that point again because I'd like to take on that level in a few different ways, but I really like that solution. And given that I've normally played these games in a sort of ghosting way, it felt kind of cool to show off my powers to the Duke before having him replaced. That kind of thing felt like a really nice.
For me, it was very much like sort of the ideal of, the sort of like buildings rather than levels idea, which is something that, you know, it's something that sounds great in theory that, you know, immersive sims and emergent stealth games should do, but is very, very difficult to, pull off in a way that actually feels good. And this is one where like the amount of time this took me probably wasn't commensurate with the amount of time they wanted it to take me. I think it was pretty quicker.
It always is, I think.
But it was so logical. It was just like, I found the fake Duke exactly where you'd expect to find him. I had the conversation that made sense. And then the place where I found the real Duke was made sense for where the intel I'd heard. And it was not the hardest place to get to. It was not in the center of the mansion. It was way out in the outskirts, but the security system I had to get through was still significant. I started to rewire them and, you know, figure that out. And so it just felt so real. It just felt like exactly what an assassin would have to do. It was like, you know, your target is not always going to be in the most protected place. They might have taken a walk to the balcony.
That's key. Like the fact that you're right. There's a building's not levels, and Dishonored is like, I played it on hard the first time, and I'm playing it on the harder setting beyond that now. And even so, it's not a hard game when you understand the sort of rudiments of breaking into places and the layouts of the maps and stuff, but they make up for that by the random placement of objectives, apparently, like, and other factors. But it shouldn't necessarily take you an hour to crack each level just to kind of go through the busy work of stealth and the different sections. Like, once you've got a plan, you can normally execute it relatively straightforwardly, even if you don't quick save too much or anything like that. And that's because the buildings feel like sort of occupied places, and it makes sense that they're not massively over controlled, or you don't need the red key card to get into the Duke's second inner sanctum. And the fun of the game comes from replaying them and seeing them in different ways, not from, I don't know, the strict challenge of solving it the first time around. And so, yeah, like, as I say, like, that was another one of those environments where I felt like, okay, I'm going to see this place from a few different angles, partly because I know that after I've done this Corvo run, my next run is going to be as Emily, and I'm going to refuse the Outsider at the start. I'm going to do the whole thing. Because I did that with Dishonored 1, and that's one of my favorite runs of Dishonored 1, was like the Thief playthrough, where it's like, no magic. And I really want to see what it was like with Dishonored 2, particularly now that it's a real option.
Yeah.
So that level's going to be totally different when you can't just far reach onto a roof and, you know, blink around. So zooming in as we are on the 3 hour mark of this discussion about Dishonored 2, I guess that brings us to the final level. Cause like the thing I really liked about the Return to Dunwall, even though it's essentially the first mission in reverse, with a big chunk of extra stuff. Obviously there's the Billy Lurk reveal, which, I guess I had seen coming. You hadn't, but we kind of already discussed to an extent.
Yeah. It didn't really do anything for me. Like she said that name and I was like, oh, that sounds kind of familiar. Do I know that name? And then like 3 minutes later, I'm like, oh yeah, I think I do know that name. I don't remember who that
feels
was.
Like one for the fandom. You know what I mean? It's like it's a moment. You
know,
you can...
But I mean, even if you don't know who that is, the revelation that she is one of the people who helped assassinate the Empress is still meaningful to you. Even
yeah,
you
I suppose
no
so.
Idea what happened in Dishonored 1. And my reaction to that was like, okay, whatever. I didn't really care. I know it's my mother. But I don't feel like every assassin at that place was all individually culpable for everything that happened. It was very much like, and you know, I'm literally an assassin myself.
I've done some bad shit.
I kill people for an objective. And so I understand.
The, if you go to her cabin, if you get her key, which I think you have to pickpocket for, the voice recording in there is the epilogue voiced by Dowd of Big More Witches. It's a word for word. It's the same recording, I suspect, because they didn't get Michael Madsen back again to record one thing as Dowd.
Right.
So they just reused it. But it works that they reuse it because it's his epilogue to the Brigmore Witches, if he survives it. Which it obviously implies that he did. I think, like, in terms of the actual mechanics of that level, it was one of the more straightforward for two reasons. One is because there isn't really a high concept beyond the fact that you're fighting... You're up against witches and mechanical soldiers.
Yeah.
But the thing that I really liked was the fact that the interior of the ground floor of the palace is exactly the same as it is in Dishonored 1.
Yeah, because you fight through that at some point in Dishonored 1, right?
You do, since when you take down the High Overseer in Dishonored 1, it's right, exactly the same. And I know that level really well, so it felt like, I know this.
I only recognized, like, the main stairwell, and I was like, oh, this seems familiar.
I suddenly had this plan for, like, how I was going to get up and around the stairs and stuff, because I've done that mission loads. Like, when I did my video series, that was one of the hardest missions to find out a way to fake, like, how to do a no-trace kill of a man.
I had a couple of problems with it that were just general to witches mostly, which was, one is I was, even on my low chaos playthrough, I was still, at this point, this was like, okay, these are Delilah's closest cohorts, I'm going to kill them. They are like the people who fully know what's going on. And there's a problem where, like, mildly annoying, that you can't do the, like, far reach pull on them. Because if you do, they teleport mid-fling. Like, right. If you fling them anywhere, they teleport mid-fling. And they...
Well, they are witches. They're not going to take that shit.
Yeah. So that's not so bad. But there is a bit of logic in the game where if you try and do an assassination on someone and they're near an edge, instead of stabbing them, you kick them off the edge. Mm. But if they're witches, they can resist that and they can teleport back. And so you're in a position where, like, you're right behind them. They haven't seen you. You want to assassinate them, but there's no way to actually kill them, because anytime you try and kill them, because they're an edge, your character tries to kick them off. And because they're witches, they resist that and they would teleport back to where they were. And so you get detected and you don't get to kill them.
Yeah, I didn't count
it. It just breaks. And it's the same for, like, even if you're trying to do a drop attack on them, if they're near an edge, for some reason you do this special drop attack that tries to kick them off, and that involves them teleporting back, and then so just all takedowns are just ruined if a witch is near
an edge. I find that the witch teleportation was the thing I found buggiest. Like, it was, I most often, like, whenever I saw the AI really wig out, it would be like witches continuously teleporting onto the same spot they were standing on.
Yeah,
that kind of thing. So that felt like maybe the buggiest side of it. This was, I mean, I mentioned this on the previous pod as well, but, like, this was the level where when you got to the outskirts of the, there's an achievement for paying your respects to the Empress, and I imagine that means going to the gazebo where she dies again.
Yeah, I haven't done that yet.
I haven't done that yet either, because that was the, this was like when I really started to figure out how far reach works. You know, when you get the upgrade to far reach, which slows time when you use it when you're falling. If you use that, you know, you can use it to, like, pole vault around. You can, like, fling yourself through the air.
Yeah, so I didn't know until halfway through my second playthrough. Was the first time I actually read the text that comes with far reach. Like, it's the basic thing you get, so you don't really think about it that much. But if you look in the powers menu and you read the text for it, there's two things. One is, if you're in stealth mode, then no momentum transfers. Like, whatever, if you're trial reaching to place A, you will just arrive at place A with no residual velocity. If you're not in stealth mode, then when you arrive at place A, you'll have residual velocity and you can catapult yourself that way. And then the other thing is breaking glass. I didn't know you could break glass with it. I didn't know you could, like, if there's glass in your way, you can just teleport through the glass or far reach through the glass and you'll just smash it. And not always great for stealth reasons, but that's how it works.
Great for entrances.
Yeah.
So, like, I bypassed a lot of that area because it's like one of those spiky metal fences around the palace, but I managed to just, like, double agility jump, catapult myself completely over it and bypass that entire section, because I know that from Dishonored 1, there is a little rim around the edge of the palace wall that is one of the key stealth ways into the palace in the first game that is also there in Dishonored 2. So I just did that.
Is,
because I imagine at some point Corvo would come to Emily. Like, if you ever need to break into this place for any reason.
If you lock that dude in the safe room in the intro.
He's a statue.
Can you still get there?
He's a Delilah statue.
Oh. Yeah.
I presume if you locked him in when he was alive. So, because that requires, so after you've gone through all this stuff and you found Delilah. You can go straight past her, where she's painting, through to the area from the very beginning of the game, all the way to the safe room. You can't get to the safe room from the outside, because it's blocked. She blocks that off, but you can go the other way around.
I was not at all good at recognizing areas in that part of the game as their previous incarnations. Like, if you show me an area of the early game and you change it to be ruined or whatever, I just don't recognize the same place at all, even if it's the same layout and everything.
So
if you tell me this is the same place as the first, as the opening of the game, I'm like, I don't know what this is.
So when you get to the palace and you have to go around the outside because it doesn't let you go. You can go up to the roof where you first escape into city streets at the start of the game, but the way back into the safe room is blocked by, like, Delilah's plants. And Emily even says, like, Delilah, like, she blocks that off on purpose. So you have to go in through the other street's entrance, which is sort of where it sort of environmentally tells you the story about the overseers trying to take back the palace from Delilah and being killed. Then you break in through the outside, and then that outside of the palace is the same as – you even see Coldridge Prison, which is where Corvo's in prison at the beginning of the first game. You can see that bridge. You can see all of the different exterior of the palace as Corvo experiences it in the first game, which is like the lower level of the palace. And then you go into the palace through the main door, and then you have the exact same lower floor area that exists – in the first game. And what I can't figure out is whether you have to, like, fix the lift to go up to where Delilah is. And that's because the throne room from the very beginning of the game is, like, on the roof of the palace. Like, there's an outdoor roof terrace with the throne room on top of it. And that is, I think, where the Lord Regent's safe room is in the first game.
But the safe room is like built on top of the palace. So I don't know if it's like a temporary building then that was covering up something else, which is why you never go to that throne room in Dishonored 1. Hmm. Or if the new throne room is like a new creation on top of the building. But when you get up there, which is when you, because before you don't need to dwell too much on the previous section, because it is just sneaking past witches and maybe, you know, appreciating the, there's a few details like the Lord Regent's chambers, where he goes if you don't alert any guards on the way in the first game, is now Corvo's bedroom. So you can go there and that's like, you can, Corvo's effects and stuff. When you get up to the palace, so like, Delilah's doing her painting in the throne room, but you can sneak past her into the chambers beyond that where Emily's bedroom is and the safe room. And that's how you get around to the safe room where potentially that first target is still,
right,
if you knocked him out, but he's become a Delilah statue.
Huh.
So, Delilah's plan to paint the world as it is as it should be and pull one reality into the other. That must have come pretty out of nowhere for you because you didn't finish Brigmore Witches.
I mean, like there's that, and there's also like it just, I was, long before I got to her, I was like so praying, just be a person in a room, just be a person in a room. I just, I don't want any fucking boss battle. I don't want any fucking supernatural bullshit. I just want
it is a bit of a supernatural boss. Just be a person
in a room. Because that's what's so good about Dishonored is like every target, no matter how hard it is to get to them, once you get to them, they're just a person. They're not a boss battle. You know, I hit their weak spots. And she, like, she is a person, but you have to go into a magic painting to fight her. And it's in this weird, like, you go into a painting in Oblivion for a side quest and it's a painted world and it's all got its own filter effect on it. And it's kind of cool and it's kind of interesting. And that was not true here. I went to a painting and it was this like bunch of rocks that looked exactly like the Outsider's world. I didn't care about it and it didn't make any sense to me. And it was just like, I killed all the replicants or whatever. And that was just a case of just standing very still and watching for them and then shooting them individually. And then when she appeared, just killed her as well. And it, there was nothing interesting about it as a boss battle. And it also robbed me of the sense of like actually killing a real person. It was always just like, I went to a magical world and I did some magical thing that in theory constituted killing this person.
Yeah, I ended up taking the real one down with Domino attached to one of her duplicates, which was cool.
Right.
But I quite liked that ending and I liked the non-lethal because I did the non-lethal ending for Delilah. I don't know if you killed her or not.
I killed her.
Okay.
What does it look like if you do non-lethal?
So
I did do the I corrupted the rune on the throne and then I went to the painting. And
Gilda.
Yeah.
So you take her out of the painting and you put her on. It's kind of weird because what happens is you knock her out in the painted world, then you put her on the throne in the real world, at which point she wakes up and goes, it's finished. Like my work is finished. And she walks over to the painting and like gleefully enters it. And that's that.
Huh.
And the idea is that I actually really like it. So it's very similar to how Dowd takes her out non-lethally at the end of Brigmore Witches, which I think is the canon ending for that story based on, well, so to go from the top, basically, so do you mind me telling you Brigmore Witches stuff?
No,
you pretty much know how it all ends now. So, yeah. So, Dishonored 2 seems to be able to take into account whether or not Delilah dies or not at the end of Brigmore Witches, because it sort of says that she's come back from the void.
Mm.
But, so in the end of Brigmore Witches, Dowd, so her plan in the Brigmore Witches is to permanently possess Emily and to take the throne by becoming Emily. This is sort of referenced in Dishonored 2, but never really fully explained. So basically Delilah paints a painting of Emily using like things she's stolen, like her hair and stuff like that. And then her plan is to, she goes into the void, she finishes the painting in the void. In the Outsider's realm. And then the idea is she's going to enter that painting and permanently become Emily and become Empress and sort of take her birthright by literally becoming Jessamine's daughter. And Dowd stops this either by killing her, or basically what you can do is you wait till she finishes painting, stop time and swap the painting for a different one. And it is a bit of a Scooby-Doo ending because Dowd swaps the painting of Emily for a painting of the void itself. And then Delilah performs her ritual, but with her back to the painting she's just painted and she never once turns around just to double check it's the right painting. And so she does this ritual and she casts herself back. And then if you've done the non-lethal version, she
she doesn't notice till it's too late that she's right. just cast herself into the void. And so she's trapped in the void forever. And that's presumably like, I think that's probably the canon ending because that's what she seems to have come back from in Dishonored 2.
Yeah. It's very weird. In Dishonored 2, so I played a bit of Brigmore Witches and the name Delilah was familiar to me, but I didn't know, I didn't think of that as a person who was still around. I hadn't personally killed her or anything. And so there was a strange mix of sometimes it seemed like they knew who she was and sometimes it seemed like they didn't.
So Corvo and Emily don't. That's the thing. Dowd does. And that I think is why Megan knows who she, well, no, Megan definitely knows who she is because Billy Lurk betrays Dowd for Delilah. Yeah. So Megan definitely knows but Corvo and Emily don't because they never find out how that Dowd had saved her. Like that's that final voice recording you find from Dowd in Dishonored 2, which is also his epilogue to Brigmore Witches, is him saying, you know, I killed an empress, but I saved her daughter, which is it doesn't make up for it, but Dowd's redemption is stopping Delilah in that game.
All right.
But Dowd also fully tricks Delilah into damning herself. And Delilah's screaming as she goes into the abyss. And the cool thing about Emily's version of the same thing, because it's actually fundamentally a similar thing. She she subverts Delilah's ritual in order to trap her. But the big difference is that she gives Delilah exactly what she wants. Because when Delilah, basically what the corrupted ritual does is the world that Delilah's trying to create still exists inside the painting, but it only exists inside the painting. Mm. It doesn't replace the real world.
Yeah.
So Delilah, as far as she's concerned, is the empress of this kingdom that she's remade in her own image within the painting. And that never impinges on the real world, but it's actually in some ways, at least solipsistically, a happy ending for Delilah, which is one of the reasons I quite like it. Cause it's quite subtle. Like it's not like the other non-lethal endings that we were talking about earlier. It's not, you don't break her. You don't ruin her or take away her power.
Yeah.
You just trap her in a solipsism forever and then free Corvo. And so I liked that as a finale, even if I kind of agree with you that I think that final encounter with her is very gamey.
Yeah, I feel like that makes sense as a non-lethal thing. I wish the lethal thing was just killing her, in a normal room, just as a normal person.
Yeah,
do some weird magic shit to make that possible, but then the actual moment should just be I'm just going to stab this person because I'm really angry with her and I wanted to...
Yeah, making her mortal again feels like the mechanic of that. And then yeah, I agree, killing her. Whereas facing the doppelgangers in the in the magic painting dimension does feel like a bit. It's a bit too much of a video game ending, which actually the first game avoids. Like the first game doesn't have that moment. Like it even has Havelock. By the time you reach the boss chamber and Havelock is there with, on the low chaos version anyway, Havelock has already poisoned the other conspirators and is already despairing and will shoot himself if you don't intervene. And if he fights you, you still kill him. And he's just a man.
Yeah.
He even gives you the key and says fuck it, I'm done. So yeah, it felt maybe a bit gamey, but I like the thematic book ending, but it highlights the fact that it feels like almost more of a sequel to The Brigmore Witches than it is a sequel to Dishonored 1 because the endings mirror each other. I mean, there's maybe it's maybe a little bit cartoonish and Scooby-Doo-y that both times Delilah's attempted to do a reality bending painting based ritual, some fucking meddling kids have come along and swapped the stuff out before under her nose.
When will I learn?
Exactly. Essentially, if they do a third game and she's in it again, they can't really pull the same trick.
No.
It can't be every time Delilah. It's a little bit too, Jafar from Aladdin at that point. But yeah.
Shall we wrap it up?
I think we should. but yeah, I think we've done justice to a very good video game with a lot of stuff in it.
Yep, it's probably my game of the year.
And yeah, probably mine as well. Cool. I hope this was interesting to people who wanted to know our deep thoughts on literally every minute as it happened of video game Dishonored 2. Yeah, I don't know how to wrap this up because we didn't do questions or have a sign off.
I'd say thanks for listening, everybody.
If you want to check out Tom's Twitter for more GIFs of things going wrong in Dishonored, you can do so at
Twitter.com/Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
And I'm at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. It's almost one in the morning. Thanks for listening, everybody.